Also wasn't.
And I've learned there are people who know what really happened, but some of them don't want the truth to come out.
We found Austin's file.
Where is Austin Tice? Starting on Wednesday morning at 9:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 6th of September. Good morning, this is Tom Sanders. A key aide to Vladimir Putin is described as meaningful. Talks in Moscow last night between the Russian president and Donald Trump's envoys about ending the war in Ukraine. The White House said the envoys had discussed substantive plans for next steps, which would be announced in the coming weeks. Later today, Steve Witkoff and Mr. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are due in Kyiv to meet President Zelensky on what will be their first visit to the Ukrainian capital. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
The Kremlin says the talks between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's peace envoys lasted just over 3 hours and were frank and constructive, although there's no obvious sign they've brought peace any closer. President Putin reportedly told Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner about alleged Russian military successes in Ukraine and that Russia would achieve the aims of its so-called special military operation. The American envoys are now due in Kyiv for talks with President Zelensky. To ensure the envoys' security, during their peace mission, the presidents of Russia and Ukraine have agreed to pause strikes on Kyiv and on Moscow. At the Moscow talks, President Putin told Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner that the situation was difficult, but he was full of praise for his guests. "I would like to say," Vladimir Putin said, "that working with you is a comfortable experience for us."
Voters will head to the polls soon in an eastern German state in an election which could, for the first time, hand the hard-right Alternative für Deutschland party significant power. The AfD held their final campaign rally in Saxony-Anhalt's state capital Magdeburg yesterday. Several thousand people also gathered in the city to protest against the party. This man was among those taking part in the demonstration.
"We simply want to show that the people of Saxony-Anhalt aren't quite so hopeless after all. That there are still cool people here who take to the streets, who speak out in support of diversity and respect."
Firefighters and British Transport Police are understood to be investigating a fire which caused major disruption to rail services in and out of London Paddington. Great Western Railway, Heathrow Express and Elizabeth Line services were all affected. This morning, GWR said it was now running a good service across most of its network. Here's Greg McKenzie.
Thick plumes of smoke could be seen in the Paddington area yesterday afternoon as a grass fire took hold beside the railway. Around 40 firefighters were sent to the scene as the blaze cut power to lines between Paddington and Heathrow Airport. An Elizabeth Line train carrying around 380 people was left stranded, with emergency crews brought in to help passengers off. The knock-on effects spread across the network, hitting Great Western Railway and Heathrow Express services. The London Fire Brigade, British Transport Police and Network Rail are understood to be investigating what caused the fire.
A court in Egypt has sentenced 12 people, including a prominent television presenter, to death after they were convicted of manufacturing and dealing synthetic drugs. The verdict came after the court consulted the Grand Mufti of Egypt for his religious opinion, a procedure required by Egyptian law in capital cases. Yusuf Taha reports.
The glamorous television presenter Sara Khalifa is well known all over the Arab world for her program Mission Impossible, which covers security and crime. She's also a successful film and music producer. She told the judges at Cairo's criminal court that she did not smoke, let alone deal in drugs. The court heard that police seized 750,000 of ingredients used to make drugs, worth $40 million, from a property used by the group. 9 fellow defendants have been sentenced to life imprisonment, while 7 were acquitted. The death sentences can be appealed to a higher court.
Flights from Indonesia's main international airport in Jakarta have been suspended because eruptions from Mount Anak Krakatau have been bringing volcanic ash into the city. More than 200 flights have been affected. The volcano began erupting on Friday, spewing fountains of lava and ash across surrounding regions. The Irish professional boxer Katie Taylor has ended her illustrious career with a decisive win in Dublin against Flora Pilly of France, making her a three-time undisputed world champion. After last night's fight, the 40-year-old did a final lap of honour before placing her boxing gloves in the centre of the ring to signify retirement. She thanked the 80,000 fans gathered at Croke Park for their support over the years.
She travelled around the world to watch me to Cardiff and Manchester and Leeds, Boston, Brooklyn, Manhattan. Now you are here with me in this amazing stadium. I don't know of any other country that will sell 80,000 tickets for a female athlete. I'm convinced that Ireland is the only country.
The Irish boxer Katie Taylor, BBC News.
Many thanks, Tom Saunders. This is BBC Radio 4. Coming up next, faith, fear and the cost of going towards gunfire. One Christian soldier shares his experience on Heart and Soul. Then, in half an hour, we meet the vet with a passion for dung beetles who's taken on a farm in Wales. That's in this week's On Your Farm. And then, in an hour, on Sunday, we have reactions to the Nepal-Tibet floods, hear about multi-faith prayer rooms and Gloucester Cathedral's new pipe organ. Sunday is at 7:10. That's the hour ahead here on BBC Radio 4 after this.
Ever feel like you just missed out on something amazing? With BBC Sounds, you can ask most smart speakers to go back to the start of the show. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart, so you never miss a thing again.
Coming up next, Friday Night Comedy.
Get more from your smart speaker with BBC Sounds.
Time now for Heart and Soul. David Eubank calls himself a Christian missionary, not a soldier. But in the war zones of Burma and Iraq, he has rescued and wounded, carried the dead and killed. And a warning, this program contains descriptions of violence, injury and death in war zones.
I'm watching a video of a man in army uniform with a gun running towards gunfire. However, this man, despite his appearance, is not a soldier. He's a Christian missionary.
This is 4 May 2017, right outside of northwest Mosul. People fleeing, ISIS shooting at him.
I'm Rajiv Gupta, and for Heart and Soul, I'm speaking with David Eubank, founder of an organisation called the Free Burma Rangers. David is extraordinary. He's operated in some of the most dangerous war zones in the world. He says carrying out humanitarian work and helping people resist against brutal regimes. All the while, David keeps his Christianity front and centre of his work. People describe him as a missionary soldier.
Rajiv, can I pray?
Absolutely.
Dear God, thank you for Rajiv. Thank you for the BBC. Help this be useful and glorifying to you and good for the BBC and fun to do. In Jesus' name, amen. So I see myself as a child of God that grew up in the jungles and fields of Thailand as a missionary child. And wanting to be a soldier, but always thinking I'll be a missionary. I'm not sure why, but my dad fought in the Korean War and was glad he did. But he said, you know, you can stop a man's heart with a bullet, and sometimes you have to, but you will never change a man's heart with a bullet. Hearts are changed by love. And so he said to God, if I go overseas again, I want to go so that hearts are changed. He can't change anyone's hearts, but God can change hearts. And so I think that's still true for me as well.
David is a US military veteran, having served as a soldier for over 10 years, including in the US Special Forces.
You have Rangers, Special Forces on the Army side. You have the Navy SEALs on the Navy side. You have the Air Force, Combat Control, PJ. So everybody has something. I was on the Army side, so Rangers and Special Forces. And after about 10 years, I got out and was invited to help people in Burma, which is the longest running war in the world, now 76 years. And there, I'm not really a soldier because sometimes I don't even have a gun. And I'm not there, even if I have a weapon, I'm not there to fight the dictator's army. I'm there to help people.
Myanmar was known by its official English name Burma until 1989. For years, it's been affected by a brutal civil war, something that David has become involved with. But he's keen to draw a clear line between his humanitarian work and army background. But it's a line that can sometimes get blurred.
I remember just recently in a pretty intense battle, the Burma army is hammering the Kermini, which is up in northeast Burma. We were taking machine gun fire from the Burma army right across the rice fields. I was finally 100 meters, which is very close in real life. Bah, 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 just chomping down everything. And we're laying there running out to get wounded, Kareni, with the medical support. And then the Burma army sees us, start dropping mortars, just walking mortars on us. And we're just in a rice field. And I remember talking to a new volunteer the next day. We survived it. And I said, you didn't react the way you thought you would, did you? I mean, you reacted fine, but I could see your eyes. And I said, you cannot be a soldier here. You got to be a missionary, because it makes no sense tactically to stay here getting hammered for people you don't even know that making their own decisions. And there's no cover and concealment. And the enemy has airplanes, attack helicopters, drones, artillery. And the resistance has maybe one AK and a homemade shotgun. Makes no sense. You would not do that in the American army, but you could do it for love. And if it was your daughter up there that was shot, you're going to stay here and go. I said, so you've got to be a missionary. But because we're in war zones, it helps to be a soldier. You don't have to be one. But the most important thing in our organization is love. That's the most important thing. And that's what's going to give you enough strength to do something when you're too scared to do it.
Wounded coming in.
David, you've been in some of the most challenging war zones in the world, from Mosul fighting ISIS to Burma in constant conflict with the Burmese army. And you describe these scenes, you know, horrendous scenes where you're under some really heavy artillery fire. And here you are still standing talking to me today. Do you think there's some divine providence that's keeping you here, that's keeping you alive and keeping you doing the work that you're doing?
Yes. And I'm more scared than I ever was. I mean, the more you do it, especially when it's they're stronger than you are, I don't get braver. It's like, my goodness, when is it my turn? I've been wounded 5 times and none of them that seriously. I mean, I was shot right in the arm, but they missed the bone. I mean, I was close. I was 7 yards from ISIS. They're looking right at me. 3 of them, one close within 4 yards or 4 meters and boom. And I got hit in the leg and I got, the worst was that head injury from a bombing when I was dragging one of my dead Rangers. But none of them, obviously I'm standing here. Just last month before I came on this trip to the States, I was in 4 battles in a row. And every single one of them, people got wounded, killed, and all around me. So yes, I hope it's divine providence. I believe in God. That's not hope. I believe. But I can't prove, you know, everyone that Jesus healed back when Jesus was physically on this earth is not with us today. All healing is temporary. And the disciples themselves are not here. Jesus himself was put on the cross. So I don't have any confidence I'm going to live through any battle.
Putting himself in harm's way has become almost normal for David. I find the way he talks about the battles he's been in both captivating, but also shocking and sad. However, nothing prepared me for what David was about to describe next. And a warning, the following describes the situation of violence and killing.
I remember one moment that was very, what for me, very definitively the power of God in my life was in the Battle of Mosul. Towards the end of the battle, ISIS is losing, and we liberate this family. The Iraqi army is with us, liberate this family's farm field. They're going to get to move and go see their relatives first time in 3 years. They load up in a tractor, but ISIS is planting landmines. But I've been interacting with a family. There's a little like 3-year-old girl holding my leg. Oh, it's like my daughter when she was younger. And then they're trying to go away. ISIS blows them up. Boom. We're trying to do mouth to mouth. We're trying to intervene medics. And, you know, Rajiv, it's the first time in battle I saw people cry. Because in battle, you're focused. We all started crying. Why? We had many wounded kids. We all had a relationship with this 3-year-old because it had been a moment of calm in that battle. And the medics were crying, the Iraqis were crying, my ethnics were crying, I was crying.
And it was in this moment that David says he felt something that blurred the lines even further between his humanitarian work and operations on the front line. David wanted revenge.
I'm praying, Lord Jesus, please bring this girl back to life. And she died in our hands. And I got up and I turned to Monkey, one of my team leaders, and I said, Monkey, we're going to share the love of Jesus in word and deed. We're going to give food, blankets, and medical care. But we're going to kill ISIS as much as we can. Not because we're good at it or we're some kind of super soldier, because it's evil and that could have been my kid. That's justice. So the next morning at 5 a.m., we're going to roll into the next battle. I open my Kindle to the Bible part and I close my eyes and I start pressing random. Three times in a row, I get the same verse. Revenge belongs to me, says the Lord. I will repay. He doesn't say there's no revenge. It's his job. Human's job is justice. We can handle it. Revenge, we can't handle. And I said, well, but God, this was justice. And I open it again. Revenge. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I repay. And suddenly it dawned on me what I called justice was revenge. Because justice is wrapped in love. Revenge is, you hurt me, I don't care. I hope you die or get crushed. That's revenge, and that will eat you up. And so I said this, Jesus, thank you for showing me it was revenge. I give it up to you, forgive me. I said that prayer, not expecting anything. It was like a 2,000 kilo weight went off my shoulders. This insidious evil that I was going to carry called revenge, that I masqueraded it as justice. And when I said, I'm sorry, he took it away from me. And I went into that battle the next day, a free man, not encumbered by hate or anything, saying, I don't have to kill anybody. I don't have to fight anybody. I will if they get in front of me, but I'm going to pray first. I don't have a policy of always fight. My policy is, Jesus, what do I do?
Does it not worry you, though, Dave, that with all this killing, with being on these battlefronts, and as you said, seeing Satan's work at play, that you are also somehow part of this by the very nature that you're there? I mean, some people use that old phrase, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, so to speak. What gives you the sense that you're on the right side of this?
That is a great question. And that's a question that I ask myself often, all the time. We want to be on God's side. He's not just going to jump on our side because we say a couple of nice things. And so what we do is we pray. What are we supposed to do here? And we pray for our enemies. I said, praying for your enemy is a command of Jesus, and it keeps your heart clean. You may even fight and kill them, but you're praying for them, which puts you in a different attitude. And then if you've killed them, pray for them too. Pray for their souls. And realize you've just killed someone's son or husband, even though they're the Nazi, the wrong side, which I think most people say that's the wrong side. Or they're ISIS, which is another pretty easy one. They're still someone's kid.
Hey, tell them we got two badly wounded in this vehicle. We got two badly wounded in this vehicle. They got to get down here now.
And I remember in a trench fight with ISIS, there was three of them and very close. At this one, the one of them, I was 2 meters from him. We're right, 2 meters is really close. Looking each other in the eye, boom, 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 you know. When they died, when I killed them, I remember I got down and I straightened the guy's arm up and I closed his eyes and I held his hand. He's dead. And I remember right in the middle of that, I was rolling in and out of the trench. And I said this, I was out of ammunition and I rolled back out. Hey, throw me another magazine. And I said, God, help us be friends somehow. Help us not kill each other. I said that prayer out of one, fear, but second, I don't really want to kill this guy. It's never going to end. Like, you're not going to change his heart. And I said that prayer. And I actually had hope it would be answered. And I rolled the trench. He's like, oh, that didn't work. And when it was over, I prayed for him. And I said, Lord Jesus, I'm a sinner. He's a sinner. I really believe he was doing the wrong side, the wrong way. I think we're on the right side, but I'm not the executing angel. I'm just a man. Please forgive me. And I prayed for him. Please take his soul to heaven. So I think it's crucial to realize we're not God's executioner, that even when you're doing the right thing for justice, liberating slaves, whatever, your heart is still human heart with evil in it. And so I ask that question all the time. I do pray for our enemies. That's about love. You can't live well with shame. The shame of things you did do that were wrong, or the shames you didn't do that you should have done. That's what Jesus is for. You give that shame to him. You don't carry it. And I just say, Jesus, I hate this guy. Tell the truth. I hate them, but I reject that. I give it up. Please help me. And sometimes I feel healed in the moment. Sometimes it takes a month of that prayer.
I'm Rajiv Gupta, and for Heart and Soul, I'm speaking to David Eubank, founder of the Free Burma Rangers. He's a man who says he's not really a soldier, even though he works in war zones. What keeps him there is, he says, his love of God.
I want to take you back to your upbringing and how much religion and Christianity played in your childhood and how that manifested for you. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I grew up as a missionary kid. My father was an oilman, my mom was an actress, and my father fought the Korean War. In between that, they left their professions, went to Thailand in 1961. I was 9 months old. I was born in Texas, and I grew up in Thailand, and I grew up with Thai people, and my first language was Thai. And then I went to boarding school, and it was in boarding school that I had to decide, okay, my mom and dad believe in God. I believe in God, but is he real? I'm not in boarding school. They're not here. And I had dengue fever, so I was physically sick, and I was 7 years old. And when you're 7 years old and sick, you want your mom. She's not there. Nothing's there. So I just said, Jesus, are you real? If you are, I'll follow you. And I felt something. And later on, I thought, what is that something? It was love. Well, God is love. When his presence appears to us, it's love. And so I decided I'm going to follow Jesus.
Deb, I wonder whether you felt resentment for your parents for leaving you in boarding school. I speak, you know, times when you, like you said, 7 years old, wanting your mom there. Did you feel some sort of resentment for them for that?
No, not resentment. What's the word? Sorrow. I miss them so much. And as a little boy going there, I kept a stiff upper lip and showed, because I loved them and trusted them so much. I never wanted to say I had a bad time. And I've told this to my parents since. I never said, I said I loved boarding school. Because first, I didn't want to go. But once I was there, I loved boarding school because I love my mom and dad so much. I don't want them to feel bad. But I cried myself to sleep under my pillow. So no little, I was in what's called a little boy, the little boy's room, under a pillow, sobbed myself to sleep every night the first month I was there. No one could hear it. My mom cried herself to sleep back where they were. And years later, when I confessed to my parents, I hated it. I had great hostile parents and great experience. I learned a lot. There was things that helped me, sure. But I hated being away. I didn't hate it. I hated being away from mom and dad. And I told them years later, and I said, you know, I didn't really tell you the truth because I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I hated being away from you. Why did you do it? And my dad got choked up. He said, Dave, I'm so sorry. We didn't know another way. And, you know, maybe we did the wrong thing, but we did the best we could do. We really thought it was the best for you. And that's tears in his eyes. And I hugged my dad. I said, I know. I'm sorry. It hurt me. But I know you tried the best. I forgive you. And so as parents, sometimes we try the best and it may not be. But we're just people.
That childhood feels like it still shapes David's decisions today. Because for decades, controversially, David and his wife Karen have decided to take their kids with them into war zones.
You know, my kids all grew up in war zones. And I remember an Iraqi general said, you brought your family? You must think American children have the same value as Iraqi children. I said, I do. Under God, we're all the same. You got your families here. And I remember in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, they said, oh, you brought your family. That means you don't want anything from us. And we never took our kids purposely to the real front where the bullets are smacking like that. Never. Not on purpose anyways. But we go where other families are. There's always families in every war zone. It's not a video game. There's families everywhere. But it's a dangerous world. So many times they've been shot at, mortared, bombed, almost everything inadvertently or, you know, episodically, because ISIS will come from behind right into a Good Life Club kids program. And so they faced many of those dangers.
Okay. I will help him live in Jesus' name. This is 6th February 2026.
So every mission we go on, we pray. God, do you want us to go? Do you want our kids to go? And ask our kids as soon as they could respond, what do you think we should do? We pray, Daddy, I really don't want to go because I want to stay home and play with my friends, but we need to go. I'll go. And that's how they've been. Now they're 20 years old, 23 and 25, and they all go, but they always pray. Sometimes we haven't gone. Sometimes we've left the place. We left Syria twice early, from my perspective, because the whole family and our team prayed and said, we accomplished our objectives. It's time to go, Dad. I said, no, there's more problems. We got to help. Well, let's pray. And we all got in a circle and held hands and said, we give up our motives, because sometimes we have good motives and bad motives. You gladly give the good ones, but you're embarrassed to say the bad ones. A bad one is, I need to leave because I'm sick of this place. And we've always, as a family and a team, got the same answer.
David's son Pete is now 20. There are times that he wants to go to the front line and work alongside David. It's something he feels very uncomfortable about.
You know, Pete turned 18 2 years ago. And that when he turned 18, he was with me in Burma. And Pete was always back, either carrying or further back at the casualty collection point, not in the front. And he said, Dad, I want to go with you. I said, Pete, you want to go with me to the front on purpose? He's already been shot at now many times. But not, this is on purpose. I don't want you to go. I love you. I trust you, but I don't want you to go. And he goes, Dad, I prayed about it. I want to go help you. And he's very competent. You know, we jumped when he was six. He's now a full-on skydiver. He's the youngest guy to climb Mount Rainier, the Grand Teton. These are two big peaks in America. He was 6 years old. He's super competent. And he's 18. I said, have you asked your mother? And normally I never say that. Have you asked your mother? Yes. And I turned to Karen, my wife, and go, honey, what did you say? She said, Dave, I trust him and his relationship with God. He's not a foolish boy. He's a man now. And he prayed about it. And he's 18. And if something happens to him or you today, I will not blame you or God. Wow. That's a scary wife.
There's some villagers helping us carry loads.
My kids spend their summer breaks with us still because they grew up in Burma and they love the people. And my son was with me in the enemy trenches, in the Burma Army trenches, pulling out our wounded when the guy right between my son and I was killed. And then my son was almost killed trying to pull his body out, which he successfully did. If my kids were killed doing these things, only God would save me. I don't even like thinking about it. And so it scares me. But we pray about it and have that deep peace, like, okay.
David, in that moment, say, where you're in the trenches with your son next to you, a colleague in between you and yourself there, and it's your colleague that loses his life. In that moment, have you ever questioned, God, why him and not me?
Yeah. You know, Rajiv, when you say that, it makes me want to cry. Because these men and women, we've lost a couple women too. They're precious to me. You know, we trained them. When we first started FBR, about 30 years ago, the young intake were in their early 20s, 18 to 20, the new volunteers. I was in my 30s. So I'm like an older brother. I'm 65 now. They're still coming in at 20 years old. They call me dad or granddad, seriously. And I love them. I don't know all of them that well because you have like 100, 200 people coming on an intake, but I know them all. I know them all a little bit. Some of them I baptized that wanted to become followers of Jesus. Some of them I performed the service for. Some of them grew up as aunts and uncles to my kids, raised my kids in the jungle. Some are now peers to my kids. And not just me that cries, my whole family cries. You know, my daughter sings a song because she grew up with these people. And when they die, often she knows them and she'll sing a song for them. And one of the songs is about the young man that I was dragging when I had my head injury. And she heard he was killed because she was in university. And she fell on her face crying. She says all lines in the song. But one of the chorus is, how many times can you face the fire without getting burned? How many times can you run through the bullets before it's your turn? Deeds, not words, shall speak to me. That resonated with me because I had many, many close calls.
I'm there wounded. Kanye, what happened? What happened, Ranger? You get shot or just get shot?
On the shoulder.
My Lord, protect you in Jesus' name.
Very small.
Amen.
Very small. It's very small. It's okay.
Kanye is one of our top medics.
You're good everywhere else?
He's here in Papoon, February
6th. You're good everywhere else?
2026. Outside Papoon, Prince State.
I've seen videos of you carrying small children, a little girl who has been shot, fatally wounded, and carrying their bodies from the front line, hearing the death and destruction that you've seen and witnessed. After seeing all of that, what makes you believe still so deeply that there is a God.
Because nothing else works. When I have decided years ago to explore, what if there's no God? What if there's really meaningless and you're just here? That logic kind of ends, because who started this thing? Even if you believe in evolution, which is a viable theory, what started it? It's logical to say, in a way, when you're suffering, you watch other people suffering, there's no God, because he would stop that. But when I think that way, what's the result of it? Not excited, not motivated, more fearful, less energetic, less loving, less hopeful. But if I say, God, I don't understand you. I don't understand this terrible freedom you gave us. We want this freedom, but we misuse it. All of us do. And it impacts the world negatively. And you watch it. I don't understand that. I understand how you can watch a five-year-old get killed. But I'm not God. You must look at things very different than us. Maybe in some way, that's how God is looking at all this. The things of this world are fatal, but they're not final. Our spiritual beings are probably more real. When I say, Jesus, I don't understand it, but thank you. Help me be useful. I feel happier. My vision is broader. I have energy. I have more courage. And then I start to look at it empirically, which one works? Faith works. Lack of faith doesn't. Now, I still don't understand that much, but I know which one works and the other one didn't.
David says the Free Burma Rangers is not a religious organization. People of all faiths and none are part of it. But for him, Christianity remains front and center.
Like I said, many religions, no religions. You can join as long as you do this for love. We have three rules. Do this for love, because we don't pay the teams. Literacy in any language, so you can do proper reporting and medicine. And then physical and moral courage. That is, you cannot run away if people can't run away. That's it. And if you're too scared, ask for love, because you can stay out of love. And then I'll say my testimony, why I follow Jesus. And I say, I follow Jesus because, number one, he shows me my sin. That's an ugly thing, but better to know the truth. He forgives me my sin. He helps me not do those things. He helps me forgive others. That's one of the hardest things. Like, he gives me purpose. He checks my motives, helps me listen to others, gives me that deep down peace when there is no others. Like, this is the way you walk in. And as crazy as it looks, it's down here. It's not pride leading you. It's not comfort leading you. It's not fear leading you. This is God's way. And then I believe he takes me to heaven, or what the Karen people in Burma call the undiscovered land. And that's a great ending.
You told me at the start that you're more fearful than ever. And that's particularly about the context. And you are 65 and your children are coming into their 20s now. And I wonder how long you feel like you got left doing the work that you're doing.
As long as God has me go, as long as people want us to come and help. I'm grateful for the younger men and women that have joined us that are brilliant and strong and they can do the work, but I can still walk. You know, right before this, I just went for a run. It was a slow run, but I'm thankful to God that I can still run every day. I can still climb mountains. I can still surf badly and rodeo and ride. As long as I can, I'm going to do it as long as people want me to. And so I love being with people. I love helping them in their time of need. It doesn't scare me too much when things go boom. And I go to the sound of the guns automatically. Still, I'm more scared, but I still go. I don't have to really force myself. And as long as God has me, I'll keep doing it.
David is a fascinating but complex character. He talks about love, but in the same breath, talks about killing. He prays for his enemies, but still runs towards gunfire. He speaks of Jesus, shame, revenge, and justice, and a faith that for him does not remove fear, but stays with him, but yet he continues to operate in war zones. For David, that's what his life is supposed to be like.
The Missionary Soldier was presented by Rajiv Gupta and it was produced by Sam Grue. We hear from a vet with a passion for dung beetles. That's in a moment. This coming week, Tim Hofford will be back to crunch the numbers in the headlines.
When I first thought when I looked at the data, it was like, that can't be real.
So unbelievable, I had to check.
The programme that questions our use of numbers is back.
I heard that it takes 20,000 caterpillars to feed one blue-tipped chick until it fledges.
We're fact-checking Sir David Attenborough?
Explaining and sometimes debunking the figures and statistics all around us.
Even things with small probabilities happen if you give them the opportunity to happen often enough.
That's an impressive number, but is it too impressive?
The new series of More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting on Wednesday morning at 9.
Later this morning, Sunday worship will be a service to mark the 25th anniversary of 9/11 from churches either side of Ground Zero, St. Paul's and St. Nicholas's in New York. Sunday worship is at 10 past 8. Now on BBC Radio 4, On Your Farm with Rebecca Rooney in Wrexham.
So we're just going over the electric fence.
Yep. Pop over. Thank you. And then wander down this way.
We're surrounded by the beautiful rolling mountains of northeast Wales. In the corner of the field, I can see the cows taking shade under the trees. I'm with Claire Whittle, and these are your cattle, Claire, but you're actually a farm vet. And today we're going to talk about how you've gone from working in intensive dairy systems to becoming known as the regenerative vet. You're passionate about wildlife, especially insects and dung beetles, and you've taken on this farm.
Yeah, so I am, I'm a veterinary consultant now, so I don't actually do any clinical vetting anymore, but I was a farm vet for 11 years, so gave up last year to try my hand at farming.
And how is farming compared to being a farm vet?
Well, it's funny because I thought I knew a bit about farming, but it turns out I actually knew very little. And as far as I can tell, I think farming is just plumbing. That's all I feel I ever do. Water, absolute nightmare. So the cows move every day, so I need to have a portable trough that goes moves when the cows move. It's actually my favourite time of day, moving the cows. So this is the girls.
There are three, more than three, the little calves. One of them is quite brindled with, looks like she's got black eyeliner on and
yeah.
Her black mum next to her.
The black ones are Angus cross Welsh blacks, and these have actually come down from Scotland. So I got them as heifers last year. So these are the first time mums. There's also three belted Galloways, but they haven't got full belts. They were a little bit cheaper because they didn't have full belts because they weren't pedigree. But there's one there. You can see that's Sasspants rubbing her bum on the holly. And that's her daughter, Aurora Alice. Every single one has names, and I'm wondering if it was maybe an error to name them all, because at some point...
And you're building up your herd, because basically yes. You are starting up a farming enterprise from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. So I bought 18 heifers. I bought a bull, and we'll go down and see the bull in a minute, a Rigget Galloway bull. So he's a rare breed bull. And being a rare breed and being native breeds are really important to me as well. So, you know, these animals can do really well on this grass up here, which some people may see as sort of poorer quality grass. It's a beef herd, so I will keep the heifers and then the beef will go for meat, but I'd ideally like to keep them until the end of their lives, really. I think for me, that's one of the really nice things is if they can spend their entire life on one farm and I can give them as good a life as they possibly can have, you know, a life worth living, if you like, then for me, that's a really important part of that process. And I would like at the end to be able to sell direct.
What, so selling beef direct to customers?
Yeah.
And I mean, it sounds idyllic, keeping the cow happy on this beautiful place all its life, but can you run a farm profitably that way?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the good thing about selling it direct is you can get a premium on some of those products as opposed to them just going straight into market. And for me, I think selling the story of what they're doing here, I mean, these animals will be entirely grass-fed. They're never going to get any concentrate feeds as long as they live. I really try and reduce the amount of sort of veterinary inputs, and we don't use any chemicals or pesticides or anything on the land at all. So hopefully what some of these grasses provide in terms of their diversity will definitely bring equality to the meat. But I can't sell that story unless I'm selling that meat directly to customers.
In your hand, Claire, you've got a drum of cable.
So this is an electric fence reel. So what we're going to do is reel out tomorrow's fence, basically, so the girls can move into this bit tomorrow morning. So they'll just get a day in here. You could probably have twice or maybe three times the amount of cows in this space. But obviously, from a veterinary perspective, there's huge benefits in terms of we're keeping the cattle away from their feces. So the amount of flies potentially reduced, and also keeping them away from those that sort of worms and parasites that are in that feces by keeping them moving on.
And the grass looks quite long, and there's quite a lot of other stuff in the grass, stuff that looks like weeds.
Yeah.
Is it a good enough quality grazing for the cattle?
Yeah, well, actually, this is better quality than they've been on because I've got so little cattle. So there's only about, well, there's now 37, there was 20, on 230 acres. They actually, there's some parts of the farm where they're only getting to once a year, but the cows stay out year round, so they never come into houses. For me, cows in sheds are a funny thing. We, you know, cows don't have thumbs, they can't build, they wouldn't have lived in houses. So these cows live outside year round. And going back to that sort of native breed thing, I need animals that can do well in both seasons. So we have very, very cold winters up here. So the good thing about some of these native breeds, especially the Galloways, is they get these big thick coats on them in winter. In fact, they coat far better than I did over the winter. Feed hay out, they also get grazing. And then this grass, yeah, I mean, I think it's beautiful. People would argue it's not ryegrass and it doesn't get a lot of yield off it, but I mean, the amount of stuff that's in there, for me, you know, cows should, they should eat the rainbow. We say we should. I don't know why cows would be any different. And the benefits of having the tall grass, even on a hot day, if they've got tall grass to sit down in, the soil at the base of those plants is going to be cooler. So therefore, they can better dissipate their heat. The cows can get some shade from it as well, and potentially some shelter on some of those colder days. But no, I think it's a great way of doing it.
Right, let's move this fence.
Right, we're going to walk up there, clip it on, and then reel it back down. So we'll wander through here. Yeah, there's quite a lot of docks in here, and people have a bit of a thing about docks and saying that they're not great from a sort of production perspective, but the cows love them. In fact, I have a cow called Doc, and they're really important for dock beetles. And another lovely thing we have up here in the winter is stonechat birds, and we might hear some when we're walking around. You'll see them on the docks in the winter sort of picking those seeds off.
And as we're walking through the grasses, I can see all the butterflies flitting about. So good insect life up here.
Nature is the reason I get out of bed in the morning. This is what makes me happy. I mean, you can hear the grasshoppers probably as well. The amount of insects that I've seen, when I first came to the farm, it was quite heavily sheep grazed. So actually just leaving that grass to grow, the benefit that we've seen there, and leaving all the flowers, there's a bit of knapweed here. That's great for the butterflies.
That just looks like a purple thistle, but good for biodiversity.
Yeah, purple thistle that doesn't thistle you, I would say. Seeing this farm sort of coming back to life a little bit really, really excites me. I mean, I just stood the other day and watched, you know, a thistle, and there's a peacock butterfly, there's a meadow brown, a large white, and small tortoiseshell, all feeding on the same thistle. So again, that argument of what we decide are weeds or not, who are we to decide that? The insects are telling us that they're good for them. 6, 7, 8, 9.
I suppose as a vet as well, when you're mapping out each day's grazing, you're checking over your herds.
Yeah, exactly. So I can almost see immediately today, while just putting this reel out, what's going on with those cows. So is anyone stood at the back? Is anyone not coming up to eat? Is anything not drinking? You can check everyone's eyes. You know, I don't use any fly products, so those observations actually become potentially more critical than a situation where I put a preventative product on.
And how did you move from being a farm vet to running your own farm and being a regenerative vet consultant?
I was working in pretty intensive dairy practice in sort of Cheshire, Shropshire, and have been doing that for a very, very long time. And I'd always had a real interest in nature from a kid, but I'd always kind of seen farming and nature as two separate things, which sounds a funny thing to say now when I say it out loud. But I guess with my sort of intensive dairy background, I think a lot of us saw a lot more negative press, didn't we, around the impacts of farming on the environment. And this was around 2017, 2018. I think I just started to wonder whether my role as that sort of clinical vet was sort of facilitating some of the stuff that I could see as not necessarily good environmentally. I could always defend the welfare side. I think welfare on farms is absolutely incredible. You know, farmers need productive and healthy animals. But the environmental side, I couldn't quite stack up. And in 2018, actually, I read the book Wilding by Isabella Tree about the Nepa State in Sussex and where they'd taken it back in hand. And I read that not only do we have dung beetles in the UK, which I didn't know, but also that the products that I was prescribing as a vet were hugely detrimental to them. And I didn't know that. So,
and in what way were they detrimental?
Well, the worming products that we use on our cattle and our sheep actually have sort of either lethal effects or sublethal effects.
On insect life?
On particularly on dung beetles. And I hadn't learned that information anywhere. You know, I hadn't learned it at university or from vets or from the pharmaceutical industry. And when I went to look for more information about it, that wasn't there. And so we set up a group called Dung Beetles for Farmers to improve the conservation status of dung beetles across the UK and beyond by providing evidence-based information to livestock managers and farmers. And I guess that was kind of my in into realising that dung beetles have this role. Dung beetles are nature's own parasite control. You know, they drink the liquid portion of that poo. It dries it out. It makes it unsuitable for our parasites to complete the life cycle. And we're killing them with a chemical product. So what else have I missed? And then I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, really, and found out about regenerative agriculture. And it's a really funny place because my role as a vet is probably less needed in those scenarios where you're not using as many products, basically. So how could I make my role matter in that world? And for me, it's thinking about everything else. Things like swallow. You know, a single swallow might eat 1,000 flies a day. And if they're flying around our livestock, they're the perfect parasite control. So maybe the question isn't how do we get rid of flies, it's how do we encourage more swallows and more hirundines onto farms. Right, we'll just go back down and tighten it up at the bottom and then we'll can go and see the dung beetles.
So, Claire, you've talked about how, as a vet, you decided to look at things differently. But how did you end up here? In this bit of Wales? I mean, your accent, you're not Welsh.
No, I'm from Liverpool originally. So when I started vetting, I, as much of my family and home is Liverpool, there isn't many cows in Liverpool. So Shropshire, Cheshire was kind of the place to go where there was cows and I was relatively near enough to home.
And even vetting, you got into that by an interesting route, not the conventional 18-year-old with their A-levels.
No, exactly. Well, I did, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think when you're picking your GCSEs when you're 14, you try and decide on something for your whole life. It's a big ask. And I wasn't sure. And I did A-levels in French and Spanish and English and art, which feels like a whole lifetime ago now. I worked in retail and hospitality for years in Liverpool, which I loved. And it was great at that age. You know, I was like 18 to 23 working in Liverpool city centre. It's great. And for someone who's shy, pretty good on the communication stuff as well. Like, you kind of have to talk to people. And so it was only when I was like 23, 24, I was like, what do I actually want to do? And yeah, I ended up going back to vet school. Always loved animals, but had no intention of being a farm animal vet. I didn't see that many cows in my urban upbringing. And then I went to work on a dairy farm in my first year and I loved it. There's a lot of people in farming who want to farm, but there's probably a lot of people outside it who don't know anything about it who would also actually really enjoy it too.
And then somehow life brought you here.
Well, we actually moved to the area because it was cheaper to buy a house in Wales than it was to buy a house in Shropshire. The farm was up for sale and the people who bought the farm knew I had a passion for this kind of farming. So farming what I would call alongside nature or nature-friendly farming. They see me talk at various events and they gave me the opportunity to manage it, which was just like the most incredible opportunity and obviously something I couldn't turn down. So even though I haven't done any actual farming per se, thought we'd give it a go. I took over the farm in October 2024. We decided actually not to have any livestock up here for a whole year, so to give it a full rest. It had been quite heavily sheep grazed, and so we just sort of see what happened. I realised that is a hugely, hugely privileged position to be in, to be able to just leave a farm alone for a year. But I was still vetting, so things worked out fine. It was amazing just seeing the influx of wildlife that came after doing that.
Here we've come into the yard and lot of building work going on. Way in the distance is the old farmhouse and some beautiful buildings, but you're not in here yet, Claire. You're not living here yet.
No, I'll be living here hopefully within the next couple of years when we get work started on the house, but getting the livestock shed sorted is actually a priority. I call them the Prins, actually, which is Scouse for princesses.
Prins. Right, through a smart new gate and round the corner to
out onto the hill.
Another meadow.
And this part of the farm is one of my favourite parts of the farm. I know it looks very dry and crispy at the moment, but
drops away in front of us to this beautiful, really quite steep-sided valley.
So there, just to give you a bit of geography, they are the Berwyn Mountains in the background, so North Wales, and Llangollen is just over the other side of the farm. We tend to actually get less walkers over this side of the valley, which for me is a bit of a shame. I would love to see more walkers up here, but Llangollen gets all of the visitors.
So we're just going to head down and see the boys now. So the bull is called Curlew, and then he's got a friend with him who's a steer or a castrated male called Ginger No Nuts.
And why'd you keep him?
To keep Curlew company. So cows are herd animals, so we don't ever really want them on their own. And the reason they're separate at the moment is I don't quite want him to get the cows pregnant again. So he's got another week in here with his friend, and then we'll move him back over. He'll join the girls again, and then the cycle will start again.
I mean, what you're doing is lovely. You're building up your herd slowly. You're farming extensively. But how are you able to afford to do this? You know, most farmers would be under quite a lot of pressure to be making a profit a lot quicker.
Well, I'm very lucky at the moment in that I'm salaried, so I get some income from just actually being here, managing the farm. And also I work off farm as well, so I think there's a bit of a stigma around working off farm. Like, I think we're very bad at it in the West, but, you know, my grandparents in India were smallholders. You know, they farmed, they had, you know, chickens and goats. They worked off farm, you know, they had other jobs, and that helps me get through my day to day. And I also love what I do as a vet. You know, now this consultancy role means I can kind of pick and choose when I work, so I can be here most of the time and also work off the farm. And I think that's it's a great position to be in, really.
And as somebody with that South Asian heritage, I mean, that's another thing. Farming's hard enough to break into as a new entrant. And even the countryside, to encourage people, you know, from all diverse communities to be part of the countryside. Has that been difficult at all? Or has it, I don't know, had its own challenges?
Yeah, I think it probably has. I mean, there's obviously a certain level of racism that comes with my colour of skin, I guess, and certainly historically probably more so, but I would argue in a lot of cases it's been potentially worse being just being a woman and particularly a woman farm vet. I mean, there's definitely been times in the past where it's been trickier working and people have made comments, and usually it's just a load of hot air, I would say. Realistically, it's, this job isn't all about strength, it's about what you're able to do and what your brain does and where you figure things out. Yeah, I don't think it's got anything to do with being a male or female or whatever colour of skin you are. But yeah, it draws some funny looks, I think, sometimes, 100%. Right, we'll walk down a little bit further. So these poos are about 3 to 4 weeks old.
You've got your little trowel, and yeah, we've come in this field because we're going to have a little look at some of the insect life that the dung supports, in particular dung beetles.
We definitely are going to do that. We're going to find a fresher poo because these are a few weeks old now. So we're just walking down closer to where the boys have been over the last couple of days.
Right, so you've put your rubber gloves on.
Rubber gloves are on. So if you are going to go and fertile around in a poo pile, I'd suggest that you wear gloves. If you look at this poo pile here, see all the tiny flies all over the top of it? And there's so many different kinds of flies on here.
Are they just feeding off it?
I mean, we talk about poo from like a fertiliser perspective, and I think most farmers would agree that it is good from a fertiliser perspective, but we never really talk about it from a biodiversity perspective. And, you know, there was a chap in the 50s, I think he found that one single cow pack could support 1,000 developing insects. Suddenly this poo is like a hugely valuable resource.
But could it also be a pest that, you know, you see the flies around an animal's eyes in the summertime, and yeah, we think of them as carrying disease?
Yeah. I mean, I describe a poo pat as a whole ecosystem within itself. I mean, you pull that apart, you can see those fast moving ones aren't dung beetles, but those guys are.
Oh, so you've just parted it and underneath the surface are these black shiny insects.
Yeah, so
just running around, and you're picking one out.
So this is actually a Photius fossa, these big black ones. The predatory beetle will just keep running. See how fast it is? So it's not, that one in there is not a dung beetle. This guy, he'll play dead. So here he is playing dead.
So you just gave him a little shake, you rolled him over, and he just...
And what you'll notice, so he's a dwelling dung beetle, so his entire life cycle is spent within that poo pat. And they're kind of like oblong shaped, and they've got, can you see those tiny little antenna on their head? They look like little jazz hands, and they basically open up those jazz hands as they fly, and then they zigzag their way into a poo pile. So that's how they smell.
And why are you so pleased to see that dung beetle?
We have pests and parasites in that poo pile, but we also have, oh, look at this, look at those little jewels. See those little red ones?
Yeah.
They're also dung beetles as well. Oh, it's so good to see such numbers of them, actually. I'm really glad to see them because I know they're playing a role in
in keeping my cows healthy, really. And also because they're important in themselves. And they're also really, really important prey species. So a lot of our wading birds, like lapwing and godwit and redshank, they've all been found to have dung beetle wing casings in their feces. It's this whole part of this farm ecosystem, but that poo in itself is its own ecosystem. And talking about the things that are in there, I describe it as a night out in Liverpool. So, Phil, you've got your creepy guys hanging out on the street corners. They're going to be things like your parasitic flies and your parasitic worms and the kind of things that cause problems in your livestock. They might be handing out a few drugs, you know, a little bit of worming product. And then you've got your predatory bugs and your predatory beetles in there, and they're basically having a massive scrap. So they're going through the streets of Liverpool, they're kicking off on everything else, they want a fight, they know how valuable that poo is, and they want to be in there because they want to eat something in there. And then you've got your dung beetles, and they're just going from bar to bar getting drunk on liquid dung, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're drinking that poo, they're drying that poo out, and they're making it unsuitable for our parasites to complete their life cycles. And then on top of that, you've got all the different fly species, and they're basically breeding all over it. So if you've ever been for a night out in Liverpool, you've got all of those things going on.
You do have a unique way of looking at things, Claire. And as we're sitting on this beautiful Welsh hillside, you know, rootling round in cow pads, I mean, is there a sort of a point in your life that you think, yes, this is how I came here? What brought you here?
Oh, I think it's just, yeah, it's a funny thing. It's been a really long process. And the last 5 or so years of my life have been quite tricky in a lot of ways. You know, I got divorced, I got cancer, I left work, and things got really hard for a little bit of time, and I lost quite a few family members.
And how are you now?
Yeah, I'm doing fine now, actually, thank you. And they're keeping on top of me, they're keeping an eye on me. And yeah, it kind of makes you really grateful for, like, having an opportunity like this. Like, not everybody gets that chance to do that. It just kind of makes you stop for a minute and think, what's actually here and what's in front of us. And I get quite anxious quite a lot of the time. I get particularly worried about the climate. I think that worries me a lot. And we're seeing that, you know, today, and worried about biodiversity and nature. And for me, like, looking in that little poo pile there, that's just absolutely made my day. Like, you know, all the stuff that's going to benefit. And that, you know, that poo's going to go into the ground. It's going to nourish this soil. The dung beetles are going to do their job in breaking it down. You know, they're just, what an incredible bit of life in there. We should all just, like, be a bit more dung beetle, I think.
Farmer and vet Claire Whittle in Wrexham, ending that episode of On Your Farm, which was produced and presented by Rebecca Rooney. In 10 minutes on our programme Sunday, it's over a week since the catastrophic floods in Nepal and Tibet, and hundreds of foreign citizens are believed to be among the more than 5,000 people still missing. Among them, a group of 16 Hindu pilgrims who had set off from a small temple in South London. Emily Buchanan visits the community to find out how those left behind are coping. That's coming up at 10 past 7. Now time for a weather update. Let's say good morning to Elizabeth Rizzini.
Oh, good morning back, Neil. It's a fairly messy picture overall today because we've got a warm front around towards the west of the UK, high pressure pulling eastwards, and a southerly wind. It's dragging in some really warm air. It's feeling humid as well, so temperatures higher generally across the board from where they were yesterday. And yes, there will be some sunshine around at times. It's also looking quite blustery, especially across western Scotland. So for this morning, well, it's been a mild start to the day. Currently outbreaks of showery rain across parts of central and northern Wales, also for northern Scotland too, with some rain also tracking northwards and eastwards across parts of the Midlands. For Northern Ireland and Scotland, we're starting off the day on a rather cloudy and breezy note. There's some patchy rain, bit of hill fog. It's really quite grey and damp here. Northern Scotland seeing some longer spells of showery rain and cloud for much of the day. For Northern Ireland, again, I think it could brighten up after the initial front clears, but generally quite cloudy with some patchy rain again as we head through the afternoon, as well as another weather front approaches. Western Scotland is looking particularly blustery today. Gusts of wind of 40 to 45 miles an hour. For eastern Scotland, I think it's going to brighten up quite nicely, and we will see temperatures higher here than further west, just to the north and the east of high ground, of course. Further south across England and Wales, well, for central, eastern and northern England, there's some early cloud and some showery rain. That that's all going to clear further northwards and eastwards. It will leave us with lots of sunshine as we head through the late morning into the afternoon. So for much of England and Wales, brightening up considerably. The chance of one or two showers towards the south later on, but they'll be quite isolated. It's windy in the north, but gentle southerly winds further south. Scotland and Northern Ireland, 17 to 21 degrees, but maybe 22 or 23 in the Murray Firth. England and Wales, 23 to 26 Celsius, but the chance of 27 or 28 across parts of the south. And then it's a warm and humid night tonight. That's the weather.
What has the BBC ever done to open our eyes to the world?
Well, it's taken a deep dive into the world of AI.
I don't think anyone really understood what would happen when hundreds of millions of people started using this new technology.
Shared strong opinions from across the country.
Welcome to Question Time. Our audience reflects the general political picture across the nation.
And asked even more difficult questions with Louis Theroux.
You know, because there's a lot of toll that comes with being in the public eye. Do you keep an eye on that?
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us. This is our BBC.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 6th of September. Good morning, this is Tom Sanders. President Trump's envoys are due in Kyiv for talks on ending the war in Ukraine after what the Kremlin described as frank and constructive discussions in Moscow. The polls have just opened in a state in eastern Germany where a far-right party is vying to take power at state level for the first time since the Second World War. Rail services are returning to normal after a fire caused major disruption to services in and out of London Paddington. A key aide to Vladimir Putin has described as meaningful talks in Moscow last night between the Russian president and Donald Trump's envoys about ending the war in Ukraine. The White House said the envoys had discussed substantive plans for next steps, which would be announced in the coming weeks. Steve Witkoff and Mr. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are due in Kyiv to meet President Zelensky later today on what will be their first visit to the Ukrainian capital. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
The Kremlin says the talks between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's peace envoys lasted just over 3 hours and were frank and constructive, although there's no obvious sign they've brought peace any closer. President Putin reportedly told Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner about alleged Russian military successes in Ukraine and that Russia would achieve the aims of its so-called special military operation. The American envoys are now due in Kyiv for talks with President Zelensky. To ensure the envoys' security, during their peace mission, the presidents of Russia and Ukraine have agreed to pause strikes on Kyiv and on Moscow. At the Moscow talks, President Putin told Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner that the situation was difficult, but he was full of praise for his guests. "I would like to say," Vladimir Putin said, "that working with you is a comfortable experience for us."
The polls have opened in an eastern German state in an election which could, for the first time, hand the hard-right Alternative für Deutschland party significant power. Ahead of the election, thousands of demonstrators gathered across Saxony-Anhalt yesterday to protest against the AfD, expressing their support for democracy, diversity and solidarity. The biggest rally was in the state capital Magdeburg, where the AfD also held its final campaign rally. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
Saxony-Anhalt is, by population, a relatively small state, but this could be a seismic election. Regional governments hold real power in Germany, and it's here that the AfD has a shot at winning a parliamentary majority. That's despite being classed as right-wing extremist by domestic intelligence in this state, a classification it rejects. The party here is pro-Russia and hardline on immigration. It wants to ban schools from flying the LGBT rainbow flag, defund anti-German art, and champion what it calls the normal family model of a husband, wife and children. The AfD's critics regard this vote as a moment of peril for Germany. The party sees it as a potential stepping stone to nationwide power.
Firefighters and British Transport Police are understood to be investigating a fire which caused major disruption to rail services in and out of London Paddington. Great Western Railway, Heathrow Express and Elizabeth Line services were all affected. This morning, GWR said it was now running a good service across most of its network, although there would be some pre-planned engineering work. Here's Greg McKenzie.
Thick plumes of smoke could be seen in the Paddington area yesterday afternoon as a grass fire took hold beside the railway. Around 40 firefighters were sent to the scene as the blaze cut power to lines between Paddington and Heathrow Airport. An Elizabeth Line train carrying around 380 people was left stranded, with emergency crews brought in to help passengers off. The knock-on effects spread across the network, hitting Great Western Railway and Heathrow Express services. The London Fire Brigade, British Transport Police and Network Rail are understood to be investigating what caused the fire.
Flights from Indonesia's main international airport in Jakarta have been suspended because eruptions from Mount Anak Krakatoa have been bringing volcanic ash into the city. More than 200 flights and more than 22,000 passengers have been affected, and people living in affected areas have been urged by health officials to stay indoors and wear face masks. The volcano began erupting on Friday, spewing fountains of lava and ash across surrounding regions. A court in Egypt has sentenced 12 people, including a prominent television presenter, to death after they were convicted of manufacturing and dealing in synthetic drugs. The verdict came after the court consulted the Grand Mufti of Egypt for his religious opinion, a procedure required by Egyptian law in capital cases. Yusuf Taha reports.
The glamorous television presenter Sarah Khalifa is well known all over the Arab world for her program Mission Impossible, which covers security and crime. She's also a successful film and music producer. She told the judges at Cairo's criminal court that she did not smoke, let alone deal in drugs. The court heard that police seized 750,000 of ingredients used to make drugs, worth $40 million, from a property used by the group. 9 fellow defendants have been sentenced to life imprisonment, while 7 were acquitted. The death sentences can be appealed to a higher court.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards say their navy has attacked a US naval drone in the Strait of Hormuz. It comes just hours after Iran's military threatened to carry out more severe retaliatory attacks against American interests if US forces continued to strike Iranian ships. The warning was triggered by the US hitting 3 Iranian oil tankers yesterday. It said the attacks were a reprisal for Iran launching ballistic missiles towards 2 American ships. The Irish professional boxer Katie Taylor has ended her illustrious career with a decisive win in Dublin against Flora Pilly of France, making her a 3-time undisputed world champion. The 40-year-old super lightweight is one of the pioneers of women's participation in boxing. Stacey Copeland watched her final fight, which took place in front of 80,000 fans at Croke Park.
Katie Taylor became the undisputed champion for the 3rd time, but that doesn't begin to capture what actually happened inside Croke Park. The fight itself delivered, it was entertaining enough, but the really poignant moment was at the end when Katie Taylor, the ring was emptied and she placed her gloves in the centre of the ring to signal the end of what has been the most incredible 30-year career. She's inspired an entire generation and she had the whole nation of Ireland behind her. And what a privilege it was for everybody to be there and witness history.
Buckingham Palace has announced that the Prince of Wales will attend the funeral of King Harald V of Norway in Oslo later this week. Harald, who's been on the Norwegian throne for 35 years, died last month at the age of 89. Royal sources say Prince William's attendance, representing King Charles, is in line with the convention that the monarch doesn't usually go to the funeral of another head of state. That's the BBC News this morning. Now a look at the morning papers. The Sunday Telegraph reports that the new Shadow Foreign Secretary, Tom Tugendhat, has warned that Andy Burnham's plans to sanction Israel over settlements in the occupied West Bank risks jeopardising British national security. Mr. Tugendhat has told the paper that Israel is one of the UK's most important intelligence partners, and continuing to work alongside the country would help keep people safe. Last week, the Foreign Secretary Ed Miliband said the UK would reset its policy on Israel. The Sunday Times says police intelligence has been called into question after yesterday's demonstration by a large group of masked men at the port of Dover. The paper says officers appeared to be caught by surprise when hundreds of protesters blocked roads in the area, chanting anti-immigration slogans. The Sunday Mirror carries quotes from the Labour MP for Dover, Mike Tapp, saying that he'll be asking why the police appear to have had little warning of what was planned. Kent police have said they responded to a spontaneous protest yesterday morning and those involved had dispersed by midday. In its editorial pages, the Sunday Telegraph describes the scenes in Dover as chilling and unacceptable. It adds that concerns about immigration are widespread, understandable and legitimate, but the authorities should not permit any group, whatever its politics, to bring chaos to the nation's streets. The Sunday Express agrees, saying there is anger at the arrival of small boats, but masked men turning up en masse in Dover is not the way to solve the problem. According to the Sunday Times, 1,000 older people a day are being admitted to hospital after experiencing reactions to cocktails of medicines. The paper says taking more than 5 medications is the point at which the risk of side effects increases. This is said to be more of a concern among patients considered to be frail. The paper says the NHS is due to set out modern standards for the care of elderly patients in January. Some of the front pages pick up on comments from Noel Gallagher that he feared last year's Oasis reunion tour would be a disaster and that there was still tension between him and his brother Liam Gallagher before their opening gig in Cardiff. The comments have been made in a new film about their comeback shows. The Sunday Mirror says the tour was on a knife edge. The Sun on Sunday focuses on frontman Liam, saying he's finally quit booze. The catalyst for sobriety was the reunion tour. He explained that it was an experience too precious to spoil by partying. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
Tom Sanders, many thanks. Now on Radio 4, time for Sunday with Emily Buchanan.
Welcome to Sunday. A few people caught in the Nepal and Tibet floods have been rescued, but we visit a Hindu temple in South London. 16 members of its congregation are still missing after embarking on a pilgrimage to Mount Kailash.
Mount Kailash is so important because Lord Shiva is supposed to live there. And that's the ultimate destinations, you know, in the Hindu faith.
There's bubbling controversy over the use of multi-faith rooms in public places. One commentator argues they should be relabeled Muslim prayer rooms. And Gloucester Cathedral has a brand new organ. It's taken 3 years to build, and they say it reaches parts other instruments don't.
It hits you right there in the middle of the chest, the sound of an organ. Even when it's playing quietly, it's got a personality. Rather than just hearing it, you're feeling it deep down at the same time.
As ever, do email your thoughts to sunday@bbc.co.uk. It's hard to believe that it's 25 years this week since the world was gripped by the sight of first one, then another aeroplane crashing into the Twin Towers in New York. I remember being horrified and glued to the TV coverage as the towers collapsed, wondering if my sister, who lived a few blocks away from Ground Zero, was safe. She was okay, but nearly 3,000 other people lost their lives that day in the US. Matt Hyde was in New York then. He's since been ordained and is today the Episcopal Bishop of New York. I asked him for his strongest memory of that fateful day.
I worked in offices in Midtown, but our windows overlooked Lower Manhattan. And so we had a spectacular view of the Twin Towers. And then on that morning, September 11th, we came to the office and the planes had hit the towers and we watched from our windows as the towers fell. It was unforgettable and completely turned our world, everyone's world, upside down.
And I suppose after the initial shock, you found yourself, what, fleeing the area?
We all walked home. All of New York walked home that day. I think people didn't trust the subways. They didn't know what to do. We didn't know whether there was another attack coming. We walked home and tried to imagine what would happen next.
And did you talk to any of the emergency services at the time? Did you get a sense of what it was like for them?
Well, both at the time and ever after, that day is just indelibly etched in everyone's memory, it's everyone's story, but to talk to the folks who ran into the buildings is, it's hard to describe. There's a church here in New York, St. Bart's, that every year holds a service for the New York Fire Department on September 11th. And the firefighters come, some of whom were in the buildings 25 years ago, to remember, to mourn the people they lost, and to celebrate that the people went in the buildings who that day tried to rescue and thereafter tried to recover and enormous courage.
It also changed your life, didn't it?
It did. For all of us, you know, what do we do when the world we thought was comes crashing down? For me, you know, I'd grown up in church. It was the faith of my grandparents. But I really, after that day, found a call to ordained ministry and began the journey towards being a priest in the Episcopal Church. I think for all of us, these moments cause us to question what's going on and trying to find how we ground the craziness of the world in what we value most deeply. And for me, it is this queer sense that nothing separates us from the love of God, ever, no matter what, and that we see that love most fully in community together. And for me, first of all, that's church. And then, of course, the wonder of our neighborhoods.
And how do you think it has changed New York? How would you say now, looking back over the 25 years, what impact it's had on the city?
New York has had so many shocks in the 21st century, along with the rest of the world, not only 9/11, but the 2008 financial crisis, the pandemic. Just New York keeps changing, and it's always hard, but the best part of New York is that New Yorkers come together. We're here in the city from all over the world, really different backgrounds, different languages, different religions. And at these moments, 9/11, the day after, and the 25 years since, we come together. And I think that's what's at stake today is, can we see in the most difficult things in our lives, in the most difficult things in the world, the possibilities for greater care and connection, especially across difference?
Now, there are some people and some relatives of people who died who've signed a petition saying that Mayor Mamdani should not come to the commemoration because they don't agree with his political views. They think it would be a distraction.
The mayor of New York should absolutely represent all New Yorkers at Ground Zero with the 25th anniversary observance. Mayor Mamdani should absolutely be there. That's just part of who we are as New York. That the mayor is our first Muslim mayor makes his presence there even more important. And what he symbolizes even stronger, because his presence shows us that what 9/11 can mean for us is that we see each other even more fully. He should be there, and I'm glad he will.
Bishop Matt Hyde, and he's leading Sunday worship at 8:10 this morning. The service comes from two churches either side of the 9/11 memorial site, St Paul's Chapel and St Nicholas's Greek Orthodox Church. And there'll be several other programmes focusing on 9/11 on Radio 4 this week. Just check out BBC Sounds. It wasn't long after 9/11 that Radio 4's series Beyond Belief started, which explores the place and nature of faith in today's world. There's a new series about to start, and there'll be a live recording of an episode presented by the Reverend Giles Fraser. I asked Giles why a programme to help religious literacy is still needed.
Religion, and not always in a good way, has been, you know, front and centre of the news and what's going on in the world, and people really need to understand what's going on. The whole idea of Beyond Belief is to help people with their religious literacy, even people who are not religious. And so we aim at that.
And now with this new series, there's one that you're presenting called Terrifying Texts at the end of September, an edition that's going to be recorded here in Salford as part of the Contain Strong Language Festival. Tell me, what will you be exploring?
Well, we'll look at the bad bits in the Bible. I mean, you know, it's a complicated text. Some of the stuff in there is really quite unpleasant. Some of the stuff that sort of feels genocidal and anti-women, great violence and so forth. And what do you do with these texts? Some people sort of miss them out and prefer not to hear them. And I sort of get that. So we're looking at the sort of offensive bits, if you like.
And I suppose the thing is, those offensive bits often are the bits that get quoted in this heated, angry age that we're in, where there's a rise in religious hate speech.
Yeah, they really do. I mean, my own view is that we do keep them in, and we do face them. And I suppose it all boils down to what you think the Bible is. If you think the Bible is, this is what you should do, then they're obviously highly problematic. But actually, the Bible reflects the reality of people's lives, and violence and hatred is a part of the lives that people experienced. And so to have faith introduced into a world where there is all of that, that's important, actually.
And all the major faiths have violence in their texts, don't they?
No, they really do. I think they were written at a time when people were, in a sense, less squeamish about writing about the sort of reality of their lives. I mean, there's not a censor there. And you get to face life in its raw. And the psalmist, for instance, in the Hebrew scriptures, is there facing the sort of reality of having enemies and hatreds and what you do about it. And I think that's actually really rather important. We don't want a Bible that's been purged of all of that sort of existential torment. And the same is true of other texts as well. The problem is, and this is about religious literacy, is what you think they're asking you to do. Do you think they're just simple instructions, or do you think they're reflections of the world in which they live and that we're called to bring our faith into that context?
Right, because a lot of people say this is violence in God's name.
Yeah, they do. And if that's what it is, then this is a very big problem for religion. And it's certainly the case that people do treat it like that. Some people do. That, for me, is a massive problem. So this is absolutely about religious literacy, about how people have treated the Bible over time. The truth of the matter is, a sort of religious fundamentalism is a very modern phenomenon. And people didn't treat texts like that as a sort of checklist of what you're supposed to do in the ancient world. It's a much, much more modern phenomenon. And the other thing that's really interesting about how we treat texts and cut them up and so forth is when we added the little numbers, chapter 4, verse 16. That's an incredibly modern phenomenon. People had them as narratives and they were a part of those stories and they lived their lives up close to those stories. But it wasn't a sort of like chopped up so you can take one little line out and then throw it at somebody. That's not how the Bible, for instance, was written or how it existed in pre-written form in its passing down by word of mouth.
Giles Fraser. And the Terrifying Text episode is being recorded at the BBC Philharmonic Studio in Salford. And you can book free tickets online. Just search for the BBC Contains Strong Language Festival. Do come along. And other episodes in the next series of Beyond Belief here on Radio 4 will cover the subject of beards across different faiths, religion and the law, and the new atheists. For many churchgoers, organ music is an intrinsic part of the whole experience. But more than 400 of the UK's church pipe organs are falling silent due to neglect every year. That's according to a survey by the charity Pipe Up. Bucking the trend, though, is Gloucester Cathedral, where a new organ now sits within restored 17th century cases. To mark the completion of all the work, there's a festival of celebration with its final event, a gala concert, this coming Saturday. Well, I visited the cathedral a little while ago to find out what is involved in building a new organ.
There is scaffolding all around the organ screen because behind that scaffolding our 17th century case has been restored and a brand new organ is going in as we speak. I'm the Reverend Canon Craig Huxley-Jones. I'm the Canon Precentor here at Gloucester Cathedral and here we are standing in the 11th century nave. It's been a three-year project. The organ is costing in the region of £1.7 million. So it is a big project, but it's an important project because the organ is the instrument that all of our choirs and all of our congregations and all of our visitors sing to. It's a really universal musical instrument, and it's really important to the daily life and the worship and the mission of the cathedral. So it's a real investment for us.
But why did it need restoring?
It had reached the end of its serviceable life and unfortunately COVID did its thing because of course organs need using regularly because they're mechanical things, and so over COVID when we weren't allowed to come into our churches and use the organ it fell into a state of disrepair and so we needed to do something about it.
Why are organs so important for churches?
Organs are really important because they are the foundation of the Anglican choral tradition, which is the bedrock of our daily worshipping life. So evensong here in the cathedral every day, sung by one of our five choirs, we need the organ to be able to accompany that. And we also need it for our wider mission of teaching people of all ages to sing and to learn to play the organ as well. So it's absolutely critical in our mission.
Okay, well, should we go up and have a closer look?
Let's.
Actually, you can see some of the sort of new wood panelling, can't you, behind
these
pipes?
That's right, all within the 17th century case. And if you look up there, you will see our head voicer, James Atherton, polishing some pipe work and installing the pipes into the organ itself.
Right. Well, James, we're coming to talk to you soon, I hope.
Excellent. Good. My responsibility with this project, in fact, all our projects, is the tonal side of things. So I'm involved in the way the pipes are constructed, the scales of the pipes, and then personally involved in actually voicing every single pipe to make sure that they all sound as we want them to in the building. So every building is different, every acoustic is different, and so therefore every organ should be different. This is the fifth new organ in the building, and we're kind of hoping it's going to be the last. I sang in the choir here for 7 years, and I looked after the old organ for 17, so for 21 years I've been involved in this building, and so I think I know the acoustic just about as well as anybody does.
We've added stops onto this organ, which we believe will really raise it up to be one of the best organs in the country. I'm Jonathan Hope, I'm the Assistant Director of Music at the Cathedral.
Now, organs obviously have been in churches for centuries, but what impact do they really have spiritually, do you think?
It hits you right there in the middle of the chest, the sound of an organ. Even when it's playing quietly, it's got a personality. It has a two-way relationship with the building. So it's not just the building that is, via the acoustic, taking the sound of the organ. It's the organ feeding off the building as well. And rather than just hearing it, you're feeling it deep down at the same time. Having had 3 or 4 years with a digital organ, people may have got used to it, in inverted commas, they will really notice the difference with a new organ, because the presence in the building, the spatial presence that it occupies, is so much greater.
My name's James Atherton. I'm the head voicer at Nicholson & Co.
Right, well, you're now wielding this large silver-coloured organ pipe.
Yes.
Is this one that's going to be going into the organ?
It is. So this is called Grand Diapason, and it's middle C. It's an alloy of lead and tin. And when it cools, when they've sort of cast the plate, it tries to separate, but it cools quicker than it can separate. So you get this beautiful mottled effect on it. This is the mouth of a pipe.
Right, so it's the sort of the bit like on a flute, isn't it? It's
exactly
the part that you see.
So that's
the
wind
open.
Comes into this tip hole at the bottom.
So you blow one end.
And it comes into that. I'll do that in a second. We'll show you the difference between the electronic organ.
I really want to hear that.
So if I get Jonathan to play middle C.
Jonathan is now at the electronic organ.
Indeed. This is middle C on the equivalent stop. Now, James.
That's extraordinary. They're completely different level. I mean, yours sounds quite thin.
Yeah, it's all to do with harmonics. So with an electronic organ, they're playing recordings mostly. These are digital organs, so they sample. For small churches, they're perfectly, you know, acceptable. But in a big space like this, what you need is the acoustic to actually sort of react with the acoustics and the harmonics that's coming from the pipe. And you don't get that from speakers.
I can see you've got boxes piled up full of lots and lots of pipes. There are some the size of a pencil.
This particular pipe I'm holding is probably one of the smallest pipes in the organ. And then when we go upstairs into the organ, you'll see the ones that are 32 feet in length. And
that's
everything between that and that exists in this
so
instrument.
That note is going to be a very high.
Well, I'll blow it to you.
Gosh, that's extraordinary
high. Bring all the dogs running.
Right, OK. No hard hat. Anyway, we're going to climb up this ladder.
We're now between the two organ cases. So the case to our left, which is looking into the choir, is called the chair. This is the oldest part of the organ, and this predates the 1666 organ.
When we came up here before, you were just working on some of the pipes just here at the back.
I mean,
you can see a lot of them have been fitted, haven't they, now?
That's right. So we fitted two stops inside what we call the swell organ. So when this is all complete, there'll be what looks like Vinnie shutters on the front of the organ, and that's Jonathan's way of making the organ louder or softer. On an organ, it doesn't matter how hard or soft you hit the keyboard, it makes the same sound. So you have to have your different stops, your different colours. But if you want to have a crescendo, then you can do it with this little, well, it's not little, this box here. So you can shut the sound up completely and then have a way of what we call swelling the sound. That's why it's called a swell box. So it's like a volume control almost. There's a pedal, so there's some shutters that will send the sound west. The corresponding ones here on the east will send the sound east into the choir. And that's really helpful when you're accompanying the choir, because actually if you want lots of organ tone, but you don't want to make the, you know, to overwhelm the choir, you can send the sound west and there east.
Right, so you can actually choose where the sound goes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Extraordinary. Is that a new innovation?
Not particularly, no.
There's nothing new in organ building. You think you've come up with something new, someone's already done it.
And there you have the new pipe organ at Gloucester Cathedral in all its glory. You may have noticed them, a small sign at the airport, a quiet room off a hospital corridor, or even a door in your own office marked multi-faith or quiet space. These rooms, now a routine feature of public buildings, are prompting fresh questions about how they're used and what their design reveals about how to accommodate faith needs in modern Britain. Lack Purwall is from Pure HR and Mediation. He advises employers on workplace issues and says there are clear benefits for organisations that provide dedicated spaces like these for prayer, reflection and well-being.
The title of a multi-faith room is intentional because it does enable people of all faiths to mix together, to understand each other, to learn from each other and to respect each other's faiths. Organisations want to recruit the best people. I think first and foremost, there's a business reason why this is being done. Recruitment of the best people is irrespective of gender, sexual orientation, race, religion, or indeed any other factor. And so what that does, it hopefully creates a diverse workforce. And with diversity, that brings greater diversity of thought, greater diversity of decision making, and fundamentally better business performance. I would say 10 years ago, there was probably very little, zero to no consideration being given to having them. But as the world of work has evolved and become more progressive, and certainly what I've seen is where there are new offices and new working environments created, then part of the sort of design is about having these facilities.
Well, Jonathan Sacerdoti is a columnist at The Spectator, and he's recently taken up the hobby of visiting these rooms and says many of the spaces function in practice as Islamic prayer rooms. Well, he joins us now. Morning, Jonathan. Just
good morning.
Tell, morning. What have you found? I mean, you visited an awful lot of the prayer rooms.
I started to visit the prayer rooms, actually, after my partner, who's not from the UK, first came here and was intrigued by them. Like many people, I think I'd seen the signs all over the place, sort of more and more of them during my lifetime. But I'd never really thought to go into one. But the curiosity got the better of us, and we did start to go into them. And I was surprised, because almost always, invariably, they are pretty drab and miserable places. They're these kind of plasterboard rooms, no windows, they've got almost no features. And if they have any clue as to what they're actually for, it's usually in the form of a prayer mat for Islamic prayer and other little clues like that. For example, some kind of indicator for the direction of Mecca so that Muslims can pray pointing in that direction. So it started to seem to me that it was a bit of a misnomer. They're not multi-faith prayer rooms at all. They're actually mosques or makeshift mosques or Islamic prayer rooms or something along those lines. So I made a habit of going into them, actually photographing them out of curiosity. So I have a strange collection of photographs of some of these rooms, and then they would have other things in them. Often they would be entirely designed around the wudu facility, which is the special sort of low basin that's used for washing of the feet and other ablutions before Muslim prayer. So I just wondered really if people around the country had been in them as well and what their experiences were.
Well, and I suppose the big question is about this. You say you want to relabel them. We asked the Muslim Council of Britain, actually, what they thought of that idea. And they sent us a statement saying it's a wild distortion that they're essentially undercover mosques. They have, and that has all the hallmarks of intellectual rage baiting, they said, taking an unremarkable issue, dressing it up as yet another example of a Muslim takeover and letting outrage do the rest. They say Britain's multi-faith rooms are a small, decent piece of shared infrastructure for reflection, connection and for everyone. And they want to see more of them, but used by everyone. What do you say to that?
Oh, well, I mean, that's an interesting statement from them. I'm certainly not engaging in rage baiting. I also haven't really particularly campaigned to rename them. I've said that it's curious that they are called multi-faith prayer rooms when they're almost always used for one faith and almost always equipped for one faith. They tend to have almost no crosses in them. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a cross in one of them. Certainly not seen any Stars of David. I mean, I've Been into quite a few, as I say. I mean, Kew Gardens, British Museum, Tate Modern, Tate Gallery, the V&A. They told me to go upstairs to the second floor through Buddhism and turn right, which seemed a little ironic, and then offered me a prayer mat if I'd like instead to use one of their meeting rooms. I'm not sure why they're so sensitive about it, but either way, that is for their statement. I just think it's very curious. You know, I actually got involved in it before I wrote the piece in The Spectator because I interviewed Dr. Andrew Crompton, who is a reader in architecture at the University of Liverpool. And he's also written a paper on these and been into many of them and experienced really the same thing that I did. He estimated there's probably around 5,000 of them in the country.
So isn't it really about how these rooms are designed and how to make them more attractive so that other people do want to use them? I mean, just anecdotally, I do know of people who've gone in who are not Muslim who want a quiet space.
Sure. I guess one can discuss the design. I mean, that is Dr. Crompton's interest because he's a reader in architecture. I think that the design of them is one element. I just think a degree of discussion and honesty about them. I'm somebody that quite enjoys awkwardness in life. I think it's a really interesting human reaction. So when certain things make people feel awkward, I often think that it's a clue that there is a really interesting discussion to be had. It's usually because people feel a sense of embarrassment or a sense of fear about the thing that they're discussing. And I would say that reactions like that one about the discussion of the prevalence of Muslim prayer in the workplace or in our public spaces, it seems actually bizarre because I don't think anything that I wrote was rage baiting in any way. I have enormous respect for people who wish to pray. I myself pray. I'm a British Jew. Mm. I pray usually in a synagogue. Most Saturdays, Shabbat, I will be praying over the high holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in the coming couple of weeks. So I think prayer is an important part of many people's lives from different faiths. Some people need a specific space to do it in, a specific room. Some people don't. But I think it's definitely dishonest of us to pretend that these kind of anonymous rooms are literally multi-faith spaces when they very rarely have multi-faiths in them.
Right. Well, thank you, Jonathan Sacerdoti from The Spectator. And if you've got any views about these multi-faith spaces or even have used one, do please get in touch with us. Sunday@bbc.co.uk. Well, time is just after 7:35. We wanted to mention the recent death of the founding producer of Sunday, David Winter, who rose to become the BBC's head of religious broadcasting. He launched the Sunday programme on the 6th of September 1970, exactly 56 years ago. He memorably said,
"Religion is not boring. I think that's what Sunday keeps reminding us. It's very much part of life as it's lived now for lots and lots of people and around the world, most people."
David Winter, who's died aged 96. It's 11 days since the catastrophic floods in Nepal and Tibet. The Disaster Management Authority in Nepal says more than 1,300 people have been killed as a wall of water and rock swept away towns and villages near the border with Tibet. Nearly 5,000 people are still missing, while there have been some dramatic rescues over the past few days. There are nearly 600 foreign nationals unaccounted for, many of them pilgrims and trekkers. One group of 16 Hindu pilgrims had set off from a small temple in South London, the Sanatan Mandir and Community Centre. I went there to find out how those left behind were coping.
So my name is Sachin Bagla, the temple manager. In the group of 16, you know, everyone is very dear to us. Nabiji, as we call him, he's one of the founders of this temple, and he's one of the best examples of somebody who walks the talk when it comes to devotion to God. And his motivation to take devotees, you know, all of them really, was to just do that selfless service and do this pilgrimage, which is one of the holiest pilgrimages in Hindu faith, to Mount Kailash.
And can you just describe why Mount Kailash is so important?
Mount Kailash is so important because Lord Shiva is supposed to live there. And that's the ultimate destinations, you know, in the Hindu faith. And it's not allowed to climb that mountain. You know, it's such a sacred and spiritual site.
Do you want to just give me your name?
Neelam Kumar.
So tell me about the man who was leading that group.
He is the founder of this temple, and he has changed so many people's life. He's the founder of this. He's given us a family here. And for me, I traveled with him for 14 days. Yes. And he had given so much of love. And all his time and thinking and everything goes how he can improve people's lives, how he can give them more comfort, how he can give them education, basically. And I still have a hope that he'll come back, because when I traveled with him, I saw so many miracles. And a person like that cannot just go. And we all are just waiting for him to come back. We just want him to come back.
Clearly, you know, in this situation, we are praying for their protection to God. We still don't have any information about them. It's, what, day 10 now? And, I mean, of course, miracles have happened and we are not stopping to pray.
And are you doing anything specifically here for the families in the temple to try and support them?
So we have been doing daily prayer meetings. We've been holding Zoom calls with the next of kin to make sure that while they are distressed, we are able to provide that practical, you know, support. There are, you know, DNA samples being collected by authorities. That coordination effort is going on. There are practical considerations that the luggages are left behind, you know, in the hotel and things like that. So all those aspects are being supported through us for the family members. And my heart goes out to them, you know, to everyone, and still hoping and praying.
And do you think, I mean, it's a very hard question, isn't it? But do you think people's faith and the fact that this was such a holy pilgrimage, does that make you question your faith?
People have asked that question, to be honest. My answer to them is, our faith has to be unshakable. And a lot of people have shared that thought with me. Even some of the family members have said that. It is a Lord's plan. My guru, you know, my guide would always tell me that we are neither the controllers nor the enjoyers of our fruits of our actions. We are just here to do our karma. So God is the controller and God is the enjoyer of the fruits of those actions. So we have to trust that this is the Lord's plan. We have to believe that's the best plan that the God has for every individual. It does obviously make you think a lot, makes you worry, makes you distressed, but the faith has to remain strong.
Sachin Bagla at the Sanatan Mandir and Community Centre. Now, we just had an email, actually, about the prayer room subject from Ruth Kay. She says, I've always used prayer rooms before embarking on a journey. I increasingly find that they're rooms often now without a window, and I feel quite vulnerable in them. In the past, prayer rooms in airports felt like a refuge. Often they were a beautiful space with stained glass windows. Now I rarely use them. Well, do send us more of your reaction on that. Now, it would be hard not to be aware that the Bayeux Tapestry is back in England for the first time in nearly 1,000 years. And it's had glowing reviews before its official opening at the British Museum from this coming Thursday. About 7.5 million people are expected to see it. For such a famous artefact, it's curious that so many mysteries still surround it. Who made it and who was it really for? Professor Benjamin Pohl from the University of Bristol has come up with a new theory, and he joins us now. Now, Professor, the Bayeux Tapestry Museum in France says it was probably commissioned by Bishop Odo, William the Conqueror's half-brother, to embellish his newly built cathedral in Bayeux in 1077. Do you think that theory's wrong?
Good morning there.
Morning.
Well, you would ask me, wouldn't you? I can't prove whether it is wrong. I think it is unlikely. And it is implausible for practical reasons alone. If you imagine a cathedral space, and you just had a feature about Gloucester, if you imagine a cathedral space, open, few solid walls, it's very difficult, nigh impossible, to hang an artifact like the Bayeux Tapestry in such a way as to really encourage, you know, audience engagement. And we must remember that the biotapestry includes not just intricate imagery, but also quite a lot of text, you know, with letters about 2.5 centimeters tall. So, and as soon as you stand back even 10 meters or so, or below an artifact like that, it is very, very difficult to make sense of the text, even decipher individual letters. So I, and I'm not alone in thinking this, think in a more intimate setting where the audience gets closer to the tapestry, perhaps as close as visitors to the British Museum will now get, is much more likely to have been the intended form of display.
So what kind of intimate setting would that be? And given that obviously it's very, very long, isn't it?
It is. Well, and it's incomplete. So the ending is missing. But even now, it's almost 70 meters long. And it might have been longer still. And one thing that we can be relatively certain about, and where there's scholarly consensus, is that it was very likely designed and produced in Canterbury by the monastery of St. Augustine's and the Abbot Scolent, perhaps together with Odo. And if you entertain the possibility that it might not just have been made there, but perhaps also have been made to be displayed there, then there's really only so many venues around the monastery that could have fitted an artifact that size. And the one that I've been exploring in particular is the refectory or monastic dining hall.
So the monks, as they drank their pottage and bread and ale and drank ale as well, they would have been, what, looking at these scenes, some of which are lots of nudity in them. Do you really think that's plausible?
I do think it's plausible. One thing we know about monastic refectories, they are places not just of silent contemplation, but also of reflection on history, on a community's place within history. And it's easy to imagine monasteries as places of just solemn prayer. But in fact, what we know about monks' reading habits in the 11th century is that they read and reflected on an awful lot of things.
But if it wasn't actually displayed anywhere, because it would have been damaged by now, wouldn't it?
Well, not if we think that it might have been displayed not permanently, as we've now gotten used to it, but only on special occasions like feast days,
right,
where particular times in the annual cycle might have prompted reflection on particular episodes within the tapestry's narrative.
Well, thank you, Professor Benjamin Pohl. Great speculation there. And there's a lot more on the biotapestry on Radio 4's Normanday collection on BBC Sounds. And now, before we end the programme, we return to the 25th anniversary of 9/11 this week. Faith leaders from churches and other places of worship near the Twin Towers were intimately involved in the tragedy and its aftermath. We've been gathering their memories of that day in which nearly 3,000 people died and discussing the long-term impact on survivors and on the recovery of their communities.
Good morning and welcome to St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine at the World Trade Center in New York City. My name is Father Andreas Vithulkis, and I have the blessing of serving as the presiding priest of this remarkable church. This year marks the 25th anniversary.
We're much more than a parish, we're a national shrine. And so that means that we have our regular congregants, regular parishioners that will come to services, but we have people coming from all over the city, all over the state, all over the country, and all over the world. The church wasn't open for over 20 years. So the original community had dispersed. It was no longer present. And I don't think that anybody knew exactly what this was going to become. Was it going to be a museum? Was it going to be just a memorial shrine? But what started happening is that after the first day where we opened the doors and no one was in church, slowly the community started to rebuild. And now we have a full congregation every Sunday, people coming throughout the week for daily services, people coming to assist in our ministries, in our homeless outreach. We have regular services and interactions with other faith traditions from all over the city. So it's become a place of focus, an intersection of all kinds of people from all walks of life.
My name is Anthula Katsimatidis. I lost my brother John Katsimatidis on September 11th, 2001. Rebuilding St. Nicholas Church was very important to me specifically because my brother John used to visit the old church. So it was really important to me to make sure that St. Nicholas was resurrected from the ashes. I immediately became a member of the committee because I really wanted to feel that sense of the resurrection and to honor my brother John's memory by rebuilding it. And it wasn't an easy task. There were so many willing participants, so many people wanting to help, but there was also so much red tape and so many meetings and so many concerns about the construction of the church and where it would be built and who would be building it and who the architects would be. And it wasn't an easy task, but at the end of the day, I feel by the grace of God, it was something that came together so beautifully because now we have this wonderful place that is not just a Greek Orthodox church, but it is a place where people of all denominations, of all walks of life are welcome.
My name is Carl Turner. I'm the rector of St. Thomas Church, Fifth Avenue, here in New York. I'm standing here at our memorial to 9/11 with parishioner David Pengelly. 25 years ago, we held a service for the British victims and prayed for all the victims of 9/11. And Prime Minister Tony Blair attended. And Queen Elizabeth II sent a letter of condolence, which was read to the families. And we've inscribed those words on the memorial. Grief is the price we pay for love. David, you know something of that grief. You were actually at home on 9/11 looking out of your window.
I actually saw the second plane appear and crash into the top of the tower. Of course, we didn't know what had hit us. All we saw was this enormous gaping hole and all this smoke. It was terrifying because we didn't know what else might be coming.
Were you able to pull yourself away from the window?
Yes.
What were your instincts when you saw that?
I eventually got on my bicycle and rode up to Midtown. I worked for Business Week magazine on the 49th floor, and we were all clustered at the windows watching this horrible show that we could see it downtown. And we actually saw the moment when one of the towers collapsed. It just went vertically straight down. All the roads south of 14th Street were closed just out of sheer panic at the emergency. And at St. Vincent's Hospital, many nurses had set up tables to collect blood because we all felt so helpless. People didn't know what they could do, but they thought at least we could give blood, and they lined up to give blood in their hundreds. But in fact, the blood was not used for injured people, because there were very few injuries. It was like we say in the Apostles' Creed, the quick and the dead. People got away and others perished.
I am Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, Executive Vice President of the New York Board of Rabbis and Chief Chaplain of the Fire Department of New York.
The week leading up to September 11th is filled with many services in many places. One of the special moments of me speaking at St. Thomas Church. And I think it's a lesson for us because religious tradition teaches us that God made one blood of the human family. And therefore, I as a Jew speaking in a church has become commonplace. We often exchange places. We're going to talk about Father Michael Judge. He was a person of faith who loved all faiths. So it's important that people see this moment of solidarity because, frankly, we live in a world that is too divided, too detached from one another. So speaking in each other's sacred spaces is a manifestation of our commitment to each other as different faiths but one family.
Well, every day this week, Prayer for the Day on Radio 4 and the Daily Service on Radio 4 Extra are marking the 9/11 anniversary with some of the faith leaders we just heard from there and others across New York. Well, that's it for this week's Sunday. Lots of you have actually got in touch about the use of multi-faith prayer rooms, and we'll be exploring that much more next week. But if you'd like to comment, do email us, sunday@bbc.co.uk, or write to us at Dockhouse, Media City UK, Salford, M52LH. And of course, you can listen again or download the programme as a podcast from the BBC Sounds app. William Crawley will be here next week. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Sunday was produced by Katie Booth and Rosie Dawson. Now broadcaster and journalist Sangeeta Maiska makes this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of railway children.
This is the story of Juma. When he was 11, he began living on the streets of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. Juma is not his real name, but his story is true. Like many children facing severe poverty, he believed leaving home might offer a way to survive, or perhaps even a better future. The reality was very different. My family's connection to Tanzania spans three generations. And when I visited, I met young people facing challenges similar to Juma's. I also saw that with the right support, lives could be transformed. That's why I'm supporting railway children today. Juma earned small amounts of money selling tissues and car cleaning wipes. He often went hungry and faced the daily challenge of finding somewhere safe to sleep. Life on the streets exposed him to violence, illness, and exploitation. Over time, he became increasingly vulnerable and isolated. Like many young people on the streets, he would hide at night to stay safe, yet felt unable to return home. For 7 years, this was his life. Then Juma met a railway children outreach worker called Grace, who encouraged him to join the charity's Youth Association programme. This year-long programme helps street-connected young people build practical skills, confidence and resilience. Through regular workshops, Juma learnt how to manage money, work as part of a team and look after his health and well-being. He also received counselling to help him process his experiences of life on the streets. Alongside this, he had vocational training in car mechanics and vehicle painting. Today, Juma is 18. He lives in stable accommodation, is continuing his studies, and earns a small income. One day, he hopes to run his own vehicle repair workshop. His life now and his future looks very different, and that's thanks to railway children. It costs around £500 for a young person like Juma to complete the year-long Youth Association programme. Anything you can give today will help provide young people living on the streets with the skills, support and opportunities they need to build a safer and more secure future. And a generous supporter will match donations up to a total of £25,000. To donate, search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Railway Children and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. Please remember to mark the back of your envelope, Railway Children. Thank you.
Sangeeta Maiska, the number to call again, 0800 404 8144. The calls are free from landlines and mobiles, and you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want railway children to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Let's get a weather update now. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you, Neil. Well, low pressure is still towards the northwest of the UK. Various weather fronts passing through. Dragon showery outbreaks of rain northwards and eastwards. Some windy conditions towards the far northwest, but high pressure hangs on towards the southeast. We are drawing up a southerly wind, allowing a warm, humid air to stream up from the near continent. So for all of us, it is going to feel warmer and a lot more muggy today. Now, we've already seen outbreaks of showery rain across Wales, northern Scotland, western England, already into the Midlands too. Northern Ireland and Scotland are starting off the morning on a rather cloudy and breezy note. Some patchy rain, some hill fog, some sharper showers. Northern Scotland seeing longer spells of rain and cloud on and off for much of the day. For Northern Ireland, I think we will see things brighten up a little, but the showers never too far away, and it will cloud over again into the afternoon. For western Scotland, it's particularly blustery today, gusts of wind of up to 40 to 45 miles an hour. Let's move further south into England and Wales. Central, eastern, northern areas of England, still some early clouds, some showery rain. Clearing northeastwards, it will be a sunnier afternoon. And further south, although there is the chance of one or two isolated showers this afternoon, it should stay largely dry here. And there'll be lots of sunshine around as well. So it's breezy in the north, sunnier towards the south, lighter winds here, gentle southerlies. Scotland and Northern Ireland will get as high as 17 to 21 Celsius today. Maybe 22 or 23 degrees around the Murray Firth, though. England and Wales, 23 to 26 degrees. We could get to 27 or 28 across the far south. And then tonight, it's feeling warm and humid, fresher in the north and west.
All right, many thanks, Elizabeth Rizzini. Now here's Simon Jack looking ahead to Broadcasting House. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Neil. Yes, US envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner head from what seemed a pretty pally meeting with Putin in Moscow to Mr. Zelensky in Kyiv. What are their new ideas for peace? After Makerfield and Clacton, another by-election brings Hoban and St Pancras into focus after its MP, one Sir Keir Starmer, stepped down. We've been to visit to get the measure of the place. And do you still read an actual book? We have a warning that we're entering a post-literate dark ages. We'll be asking for your book recommendations to get back in the habit. And we'll take in the news with the Labour Mayor of West Yorkshire, Tracy Brabin, GB News' political editor Christopher Hope, and comedian and writer Kiri Pritchard McLean, BH at 9 o'clock.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 6th of September. Good morning, this is Tom Sanders. The White House has said late-night talks at the Kremlin on ending the war in Ukraine were substantive. President Trump's special envoys are now heading to Kyiv. A crucial election is underway in eastern Germany, which could see the far-right AfD party win power at a state level for the first time. A volcanic eruption has caused the suspension of several hundred flights at Indonesia's main international airport. Donald Trump's envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, are expected to arrive in Kyiv for their first visit to Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion. Last night, they met President Putin in Moscow for what the Kremlin described as highly useful talks. The White House said the envoys had discussed substantive plans for next steps, which will be announced in the coming weeks. From Kyiv, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports.
For nearly 2 years, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner have made visits to Moscow to seek an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. Today, they're expected to get their first sense of how the conflict looks on the ground in Kyiv. President Zelensky said he had spoken to both men and was ready for a substantive conversation. The Kremlin said Vladimir Putin had held 3 hours of constructive and frank talks with the US mediators. It said Russia's president had spoken of tangible advances on the battlefield and the need to address the root causes of the conflict, language that gave no sign he was ready to compromise. The White House said Mr. Trump's envoys had discussed substantive plans for next steps and looked forward to equally productive meetings in Kyiv. The government here will welcome the chance to give its assessment of the war, but hopes for a breakthrough are low, and diplomats expect a hard winter of fighting ahead.
Voters are heading to the polls in an eastern German state in an election which could, for the first time, hand the hard-right Alternative für Deutschland party significant power. Ahead of the election, thousands of demonstrators gathered across Saxony-Anhalt yesterday to protest against the AfD, expressing their support for democracy, diversity and solidarity. The biggest rally was in the state capital Magdeburg, where the AfD also held its final campaign rally. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
Saxony-Anhalt is, by population, a relatively small state, but this could be a seismic election. Regional governments hold real power in Germany, and it's here that the AfD has a shot at winning a parliamentary majority. That's despite being classed as right-wing extremist by domestic intelligence in this state, a classification it rejects. The party here is pro-Russia and hardline on immigration. It wants to ban schools from flying the LGBT rainbow flag, defund anti-German art, and champion what it calls the normal family model of a husband, wife and children. The AfD's critics regard this vote as a moment of peril for Germany. The party sees it as a potential stepping stone to nationwide power.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards say their navy has attacked a US naval drone in the Strait of Hormuz. It comes just hours after Iran's military threatened to carry out more severe retaliatory attacks against American interests if US forces continue to strike Iranian ships. The warning was triggered by the US hitting three Iranian oil tankers yesterday. It said the attacks were a reprisal for Iran launching ballistic missiles towards two American ships. Rail services have resumed after a fire caused major disruption in and out of London Paddington yesterday. This morning, National Rail said the disruption to the Elizabeth Line, Heathrow Express and Great Western Railway had ended. Greg McKenzie reports.
Thick plumes of smoke could be seen in the Paddington area yesterday afternoon as a grass fire took hold beside the railway. Around 40 firefighters were sent to the scene as the blaze cut power to lines between Paddington and Heathrow Airport. An Elizabeth Line train carrying around 380 people was left stranded, with emergency crews brought in to help passengers off. The knock-on effects spread across the network, hitting Great Western Railway and Heathrow Express services. The London Fire Brigade, British Transport Police and Network Rail are understood to be investigating what caused the fire.
Flights from Indonesia's main international airport in Jakarta have been suspended because eruptions from Mount Anak Krakatau have been bringing volcanic ash into the city. The volcano began erupting on Friday, spewing fountains of lava and ash across surrounding regions. Our Jakarta correspondent Lisa Tambunan reports.
The airport closure has grounded more than 200 flights and stranded more than 22,000 travellers at Indonesia's biggest airport. The disruption follows continuous activity from Mount Anak Krakatau, which began erupting late on Friday, sending volcanic ash into the skies and across surrounding areas. Disaster response teams plan cloud seeding operations today in an attempt to disperse airborne ash, though dry season weather means such measures could have limited impact. Health officials are advising residents in areas affected by the ash to wear masks and remain indoors.
A court in Egypt has sentenced 12 people to death, including a prominent television presenter, after they were convicted of manufacturing and dealing in synthetic drugs. The TV presenter, Sarah Khalifa, best known for her programme Mission Impossible, which covers security and crime, told Cairo's criminal court that she didn't smoke, let alone deal in drugs. The death sentences can be appealed to a higher court. The Irish professional boxer Katie Taylor has ended her illustrious career with a decisive win in Dublin against Flora Pilli of France, making her a three-time undisputed world champion. The 40-year-old is one of the pioneers of women's participation in the sport. Speaking at Croke Park in front of 80,000 fans last night, the super lightweight champion thanked her father for his support and guidance over the years.
My dad was the first person who brought me to the boxing gym as a 10-year-old. He taught me how to fight, and he led me to 5 World Championship gold medals, 6 Europeans, 5 EUs, the European Games, and an Olympic title. And none of this would have been possible without his brilliant coach. And women's boxing in this country wouldn't be where it is without his contributions down to years. So thanks for everything, Dad. I love you.
For any fans of the musical My Fair Lady, getting the bridegroom to the church on time should ring a few bells. But for one groom from Guildford in Surrey, it's been more a case of getting him to the wicket on time. Judith Ecott has the story.
Peter Meluish has played for his local cricket club Blackheath since he was 6. And this year they've made it to the final of the Causton Press Village Cup at Lord's Cricket Ground. The team captain is thrilled, but has also described it as a logistical nightmare. And that's because the cricket match takes place in London at 11 o'clock this morning. And Peter married his partner, Izzy Upton, yesterday in North Wales. Realising his dilemma, Peter's clubmates rallied round, raising enough money for the newlyweds to fly by helicopter to the match. Although he can't promise any runs or wickets, Peter described the support as amazing, saying it had helped make a long-held dream come true.
That's the BBC News. Time now for a look at the morning papers. The Sunday Telegraph reports that the new Shadow Foreign Secretary Tom Tugendhat has warned that Andy Burnham's plans to sanction Israel over settlements in the occupied West Bank risks jeopardising British national security. Mr Tugendhat has told the paper that Israel is one of the UK's most important intelligence partners and continuing to work alongside the country would help keep people safe. Last week, the Foreign Secretary Ed Miliband said the UK would reset its policy on Israel. The Sunday Times says police intelligence has been called into question after yesterday's demonstration by a large group of masked men at the port of Dover. The paper says officers appeared to be caught by surprise when hundreds of protesters blocked roads in the area, chanting anti-immigration slogans. The Sunday Mirror carries quotes from the Labour MP for Dover, Mike Tapp, saying that he'll be asking why the police appear to have had little warning of what was planned. Kent police have said they responded to a spontaneous protest yesterday morning and those involved had dispersed by midday. In its editorial pages, the Sunday Telegraph describes the scenes in Dover as chilling and unacceptable. It adds that concerns about immigration are widespread, understandable and legitimate, but that the authorities should not permit any group, whatever its politics, to bring chaos to the nation's streets. The Sunday Express agrees, saying there is anger at the arrival of small boats, but masked men turning up en masse in Dover is not the way to solve the problem. According to the Sunday Times, 1,000 older people a day are being admitted to hospital after experiencing reactions to cocktails of medicines. The paper says taking more than 5 medications is the point at which the risk of side effects increases. This is said to be more of a concern among patients considered to be frail. The paper says the NHS is due to set out modern standards for the care of elderly patients in January. Finally, some of the front pages pick up on comments from Noel Gallagher that he feared last year's Oasis reunion tour would be a disaster and that there was still tension between him and his brother Liam before their opening gig in Cardiff. The comments have been made in a new film about their comeback shows. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
Tom Sanders, many thanks indeed. This is BBC Radio 4. It's time now for Sunday Worship, which marks the 25th anniversary of 9/11 and comes from two churches either side of the World Trade Center in New York. The service is opened by Bishop Matthew Hyde at the 9/11 Memorial Pool.
Good morning. I'm Matthew Hyde, the Bishop of New York. This morning's Sunday worship comes from Ground Zero, where the Twin Towers once stood. We're standing in front of the North Pool part of the 9/11 memorial, and worship will come from two churches on either side of Ground Zero. St. Paul's Chapel, part of historic Trinity Church, and St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church. We're observing the 25th anniversary of the attacks on September 11th, 2001. The days after the attacks, the world gathered in prayer. We gather again for this 25th observance in prayer and solidarity. In a moment, the Trinity Choir will sing Abide With Me, and we'll join Mother Kristen Miles and Father Patrick Williams at St. Paul's Chapel.
Eternal God, in whose perfect kingdom no sword is drawn but the sword of righteousness, no strength known but the strength of love, so mightily spread abroad your Spirit that all peoples may be gathered under the banner of the Prince of Peace, as children of one Father, to whom be dominion and glory, now and forever. Amen.
To speak of St. Paul's Chapel in the aftermath of the collapsed World Trade Center towers is to point to an ineffable force of recovery and care. St. Paul's Chapel is just steps from where the towers stood, a place that was called the Pile. The chapel doors were continually open to those working on the pile, brave and determined people toiling on an assembly line to lift buckets of rubble, seeking to find whomever could be found. Clergy went out from its doors to bless bodies. Medics went out, attending to workers. Dazed and ash-covered helpers came in. They ate and slept in our pews. Volunteers of all kinds, chefs, massage therapists, musicians, medical personnel, good Samaritans, fed them, gave them water and clean socks, listened and ministered to them. Miraculously, St. Paul's Chapel could hold all this under its roof, undamaged. In the churchyard right outside its doors, a sycamore tree, hundreds of years old, took the brunt of the impact of debris from the falling towers. This chapel, the sycamore tree, and courageous people were a refuge amidst destruction.
Thank you.
the word that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations, and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore."
The people who died on 9/11 were from all over the world, so many cultures, faiths, backgrounds. Many were seeking to accomplish their dream in one place. Isaiah's reading speaks to a metaphorical gathering, a vision and dream for all of us. Come, let us go up the mountain. Let us see more clearly. To learn the ways of God and walk in God's path is to move beyond reverence for what is only like ourselves. We are to learn to bear fear and difficult emotions rather than seeking to transfer them by dominating and controlling others. Isaiah reminds us that we can learn how to tolerate the restlessness and conflict of the human condition without lashing out. We have this capacity. We are to learn this rather than war. Isaiah calls all to come out of the valleys of self-righteousness. This is the path to peace, to wise judgment. It starts in our homes, our villages, in our offices, and on our city streets. We are many peoples. On this day, let us take our place to honor those whose lives were cut short. Let us stream to the mountain from wherever we are and from all the places our ancestors have been. Our anthem, "We Shall Walk Through the Valley in Peace," by Undine Smith Moore, reminds us that along the way, we do not walk alone.
We shall.
After it all crashed down, we walked home. Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, was a beautiful blue sky morning in New York City. I worked for a group supporting students helping their communities. Our offices were completely ordinary, except for an extraordinary view of the Twin Towers downtown. So on that bright blue sky, terrible morning, we had a picture-perfect view of the world coming completely apart. 9/11 is everyone's story, wherever we lived. We all remember where we were, what we were doing. Most of us can still feel the pit in our stomach when we remember. The world changed for all of us. In New York that day, we walked home because we didn't trust the subways. We didn't know what would happen next. We were so sure, so afraid, that another attack was coming, and coming soon. And on that long walk home, the brief verse from St. Paul's epistle to the Romans kept running through my mind. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Nothing, not terror attacks, not forever wars, not financial crisis, not political mayhem, not a global pandemic, can separate us from God's love. But what was at stake on that day, now long ago, and has felt at stake every day since, is whether we can be separated from each other. Our faith affirms that because God loves us, we love each other. But the events of this century have made that connection ever more difficult. 9/11 is morally overwhelming. In the years since, we have used security as the excuse to build walls and separate us further, to cast out. Yet, the immediate response to the attacks was kindness and prayer globally, and courage and recovery here at Ground Zero. You can hear the waterfall from the memorial just behind us. Those first days were a moment of solidarity that passed too quickly. Do we have enemies everywhere? Do we share a common humanity across diversity and difference? What happens next? What happened next for me after that September day is I finally answered a call to ordained ministry. I had the privilege of serving as a priest at Trinity Church here in Lower Manhattan. And for a decade, I watched the Trade Center rebuilt with my new office window. My call was to serve a God of love, to build communities of safety, belonging, and freedom. I know that even the most awful catastrophes aren't the end of the story. The world can be rebuilt. 9/11 is everyone's story. We still get to decide what happens next. On our long walk home through a scared and crowded New York, we didn't check for political agreement or religious background. We just walked together and made room for each other. That can be our observance now. Day by day, in each of our neighborhoods, make room. We are all beloved. We are inseparable from God. And we do not walk home alone.
I'm Father Andreas Vifulkas. Just three blocks from St. Paul's Chapel stand St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine. Originally built in 1916 by Greek immigrants, it was a small neighborhood church where office workers, local residents, first responders, and visitors from around the world would stop to light a candle and offer a prayer. On September 11, 2001, St. Nicholas became the only house of worship destroyed in the terrorist attacks. When the South Tower collapsed, the little church disappeared beneath the steel and concrete of the collapsing South Tower. For many, it symbolized another heartbreaking loss. But for us, that was never the end of the story. After years of prayer, perseverance, and extraordinary generosity from people throughout the world, St. Nicholas was rebuilt and reopened in 2022 as the National Shrine of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America. Today it stands not only beside the 9/11 memorial, but as a witness that faith can rise after tragedy and that hope can be rebuilt one life at a time. Our patron, St. Nicholas, was a 4th-century bishop known for his compassion, generosity, and courage. He cared for the poor, defended the innocent, and became the patron saint of sailors because he guided people safely through life's storms. There could be no more fitting patron for a church standing beside Ground Zero. We now hear the Apolitikion of St. Nicholas.
Κανόνα πίστεως και εικόνα πραότητος εν κρατίας διδασκαλών ανέδειξες τη πίμνη σου ή των πραγμάτων αλήθεια δια τούτο εκτίσω τη ταπεινώση τα υψηλά, την πτωχία τα πλούσια. Πάτε ιεράρχα Νικόλαε, πρέσβευε Χριστό το Θεό, σωθήνε τας ψυχάς.
The story of September 11th is ultimately not about buildings. It is about people. One of our beloved parishioners, Anthula Katsimatidis, lost her brother John in the attacks. Today she shares not only her family's story of loss, but also the faith and hope that have sustained them over these 25 years.
My brother John and thousands of other innocent people were killed so senselessly 25 years ago on September 11th, 2001. This is where their souls left their bodies, in this entire area, the entire 16-acre footprint that included St. Nicholas, and that is what makes it sacred ground. I believe that St. Nicholas interceded for these souls, which is why there's an icon above me, which is one of my favorites. St. Nicholas here is depicted twice, as a guide and as a rescuer. The top part of the icon shows him rescuing seafarers during a storm, as if guiding the 9/11 survivors to safety on that tragic day. The bottom portion of the icon, we see the turbulent waves becoming clouds of smoke above the remains of the Twin Towers, shifting to the 9/11 victims. The young man being rescued becomes a soul saved from the ashes for eternal life in God. With this in mind, I believe in my heart that John is safe. They all are. St. Nicholas isn't just a pretty place made of marble. It isn't a typical house of worship. And it isn't just for Greek Orthodox Christians. It welcomes all people as an everlasting tribute to the 9/11 victims. And for that, I am so grateful and so proud. The rebuilding, or the resurrection, of St. Nicholas has served as a bridge from tragedy to hope. This location, which has brought me so much sadness for so long, is now a source of happiness for me, because I got married here in 2023, which has created new happy memories. I, of course, should mention that my brother John used to go to the original church on the way to work or after work or on his lunch hour, and he would light candles, say a prayer, attend a liturgy, maybe go to look for pretty girls. Johnny Bodacious, as he was known to many, had a very wild side, an incredible sense of humor, a flair for the outrageous. But he was a man of tremendous faith. And honestly, the more time that has passed without him, the more I've realized that his powerful light that shined so bright was a gift from God. I was so fortunate to be on the receiving end of my brother's light for 31 years. I miss him with all my heart, every single day. But I continue to feel him and his light, not just here at St. Nicholas and at the memorial, but everywhere.
With the saints,
one of the first things visitors see as they approach St. Nicholas is an inscription carved into the exterior of the shrine. Those words are not simply part of the architecture, they are the theology of this church. We'll hear them now from the 15th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John. Greater love has no man than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command, love each other. Today's gospel contains some of the most beautiful words ever spoken by Christ. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Those words are no longer simply a passage of scripture for us. They became a living reality on September 11th. We remember the firefighters who climbed upward while others were coming down, the police officers who ran toward danger, the emergency medical personnel, the chaplains, the ordinary men and women who risked everything to save people they had never met. They remind us that love is never merely a feeling. Love is sacrifice. Love is service. Love always gives itself for another. That is how Christ loved the world. It is also how so many people loved one another on that day. September 11th was one of humanity's darkest days. Yet darkness never has the final word. The light of Christ continues to shine, not because suffering is ignored, but because God's love is greater than tragedy, greater than hatred, and even greater than death itself. As we mark the 25th anniversary of September 11th, we remember with gratitude the lives that were lost and the extraordinary courage of those who served others. But remembrance alone is not enough. The gospel calls us to become people who live differently because we remember, to choose compassion over indifference, forgiveness over hatred, peace over violence, love over fear. People sometimes ask me if St. Nicholas is a memorial church. I gently tell them, no, it is a living church beside a memorial. We honor the past, but our mission is to bring hope to those who are living today, because the final chapter of September 11th is not destruction. It is resurrection. Not simply the resurrection of a building, but the resurrection of hope, the resurrection of faith, the resurrection of a community, and the quiet confidence that the light of Christ still shines in the darkness, and the darkness will never overcome it.
For the peace of the whole world, Kyrie eleison. For the city of New York, Kyrie eleison. For every nation represented here today, first responders, members of the armed forces, police officers, firefighters, emergency medical personnel, and all who continue to place themselves in harm's way for the sake of others. For the victims of September 11th, that their memory may be eternal. Their families and all who continue to grieve. For those whose wounds are visible and those whose wounds remain hidden. For reconciliation among people and nations. That swords may truly become plowshares. Hatred may be give way to forgiveness. That fear may yield to hope. Ourselves may become instruments of Christ's peace.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. As we conclude this service from St. Paul's Chapel in St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine, may we carry with us the witness of these two sacred places. One became a refuge in the midst of disaster. The other rose again from the ashes of destruction. Together they proclaim the same truth. Hope is stronger than despair. Love is stronger than hatred. Light is stronger than darkness. May the memory of all who lost their lives be eternal. And may Almighty God bless you, keep you, and fill your hearts with his peace. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Peace I Leave With You, sung by Trinity Choir, directed by Melissa Attenbury. Sunday worship came from St. Paul's Chapel and St. Nicholas's Greek Orthodox Church and was led by Matthew Hyde, the Bishop of New York. The producer was Miriam Williamson. Now let's take a look ahead to tomorrow morning.
Cafe Hope on BBC Radio 4.
I gravitated towards support work because I wanted to help people.
Where people try to make the world a better place.
Parents are just so grateful somebody is thinking about them.
Share stories about the times when things go well.
A lot of people don't know their neighbours. It was really amazing to put those barriers down and just get to know where everyone is.
Cafe Hope with me, Rachel Burden, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It led to something that's so much bigger.
Monday mornings at 9:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Now, history told by the people who were there. It's Witness History with Phil Jones.
I'm taking you back to the capital of Austria, Vienna, in 1948, and the making of a masterpiece of noir cinema, The Third Man.
Come out, whoever you are.
This is the moment that the film's star, Orson Welles, is revealed by a shard of light. It's one of the most dramatic opening appearances in movie history.
Holly Martins shouted, come out, wherever you are. The famous shot, Orson Welles' entrance in the film, which is, I think, one of the greatest entrances of all times. Whoever saw the rushes and had not been on the set was amazed at that shot.
Angela Allen was a 19-year-old continuity assistant.
I was very excited about getting the job and being told that the location was in Vienna.
In the late 1940s, Orson Welles was a towering figure in world cinema. He'd already directed the critically acclaimed Citizen Kane. In The Third Man, he's playing the anti-hero Harry Lime, one of his most celebrated roles.
Orson Welles' presence is immense in the film, but he was only interested in himself and his scenes.
The movie is set in the shadowy ruins of post-war Vienna and is essentially a story of good versus evil. It follows the American writer Holly Martins, played by Joseph Cotten, as he investigates the mysterious death of his friend Harry Lime. Lime has feigned his own death to escape from the police. This first appearance by Welles comes halfway through the film. Until then, his character is only spoken about, adding to the mystery.
The fact of his entrance being silent was, I think, even more magical.
For a few seconds, Welles smiles. I've heard it's called the most famous smile since the Mona Lisa.
Was it a smile? Was it a smirk? Oh, I think it's the mixture of the two.
Welles's brief but magnetic performance transforms the film. He dominates key scenes, from the famous cuckoo clock speech to the final pursuit through the sewers. But when the director, Carol Reed, needed his star on set, he wasn't there.
When Orson Welles was required, he went missing. When they wanted him, they called Paris and sent somebody to collect him. And the poor person got there and he'd flown, I think, to Rome because he was very mischievous. I'm sure he considered it probably a small film. It wasn't going to be a Citizen Kane for him.
When he did arrive, it was a case of real events being just like the movie. In other words, the bad boy turns up late and steals the show. While Welles was keeping everyone waiting, Angela was given another job.
My unit used to do the cat shots. So you had an original in Vienna so that when you needed another cat, you had to get one with the same markings on it or as near as you could. Cats are really quite fussy, so to get them to lick the boots and look up at Orson Welles was quite a trial. Yes, the cat revealed him to be alive because he recognised him and smelt him, and that's why he'd crawled into the doorway to be on his feet.
The cat was crucial in exposing Harry Lime as the villain.
The cat looks up at Welles because obviously he'd been his boss, and cats, like many animals, when they have an owner, that's who they feel most loyal to.
Another important moment happens on Vienna's huge 65-metre-tall Ferris wheel.
I think the scene in the wheel was important because it is the only time that you see Orson and Joe Cotten together.
This is the emotional core of the film, symbolising a battle between good and evil. Cotten, the good guy, Welles, the bad.
We just finished the war, but Austria was a pretty evil country. After all, it is the country from which Hitler came.
After the Second World War and the Holocaust, the cost of human life was cheap. Listen to Welles.
Nobody thinks in terms of human beings. Governments don't. Why should we? They talk about the people and the proletariat. I talk about the suckers and the mugs.
No one thinks of human beings anymore. Well, that perhaps is the remark a greedy, egotistical man would make, because he doesn't give a damn about anybody except himself.
High above the city, the two men watch the people below. Welles's character, Lime, coldly suggests he'd erase one of those human dots without hesitation if the price was right.
Down there, would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I offered you £20,000 for every dot that stopped, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spend?
You are asking me, you know, it's good versus evil. Yes, of course it is, but he was an evil man. Harry Lime was an evil man.
Wells used to brag he wrote all his own lines. Not true. But he was responsible for the most famous words in the film, the cuckoo clock quote.
The cuckoo clock turned into a great line, but it was certainly not thought of at the time.
But it became absolutely crucial, emphasising Lyme's chilling belief that human suffering is inconsequential if it leads to profit and greatness.
Naturally, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock.
That's the line everyone remembers, but the film's climax is pretty exciting too, as Wells is hunted down beneath the city streets.
The character Harry Lyme disappears into a kiosk which leads into the sewers, so then it becomes the chase in the sewers to the end.
But again, Wells proved to be difficult.
When he arrived at the sewers, he saw all the crew eating their sandwiches, and he went mad. He thought it was disgusting, and he refused to ever go down the sewers again.
They ended up having to make a replica set.
No, Mr. Wells would not go down the sewers, so it cost them quite a lot of money to have to rebuild the sewers in London.
Was there an expectation that the film was going to be this great masterpiece?
At the time, no. We all hoped it was going to be a success, but nobody knew.
It's a lot of people's favourite film. Is it yours?
I don't have favourites. I've worked on too many films. It's certainly one of the most memorable, but it's hard to say it's my favourite film. Am I proud of being part of it? Well, in retrospect, yes. You do not know. You take on a job. You try to do it as well as you can, but you never know how it's going to turn out.
Carol Reed's The Third Man was released by London Films in 1949 to both popular and critical acclaim. It won a Best Cinematography Oscar in 1951, and in 1999, the British Film Institute voted it the greatest British film of all time. Angela Allen worked on more than 100 films, including The African Queen and Murder on the Orient Express. She was speaking to me, Phil Jones, for Witness History.
And for more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, you can search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. This is BBC Radio 4 Broadcasting Houses coming up in a moment or so. But first, it's time for Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton. It's presented today by the conservationist Isabella Tree.
This is a sound that might have echoed around Britain hundreds of years ago, the bill clattering of white storks. It's now a characteristic sound of spring in our rewilding project at Knepp in West Sussex. Since 2020, white storks have been nesting here in the tops of oak trees, the first to breed in England for centuries. Their bill clattering is mostly an amorous pair bonding thing. They throw back their heads and clack their long red beaks as if they're applauding each other. Knepp is one of two sites where the White Stork Project has established a colony. Without a colony, the 30 or so white storks that adventure over to the UK from Europe every spring fail to find a place where they feel confident enough to breed. Now we have more than 20 nests at Knepp, and wild white storks have begun to breed with our reintroduced birds. Their offspring are now flying as far as Morocco, mingling with flocks of wild white storks on their winter migration. A number of them have made it back to Knepp again to nest. They now know this landscape.